Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, July 22nd, 2019. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, our access code 449-389-pound. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, last week we ended with the Gospel of John. So this week we're going to start in the Gospel of Mark. Gospel of Mark, chapter 1, verses 1 through 13. The beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as it is written in the prophet, "Behold, I send my messenger before thy face, which shall prepare the way before thee." The voice of one crying in the wilderness, "Prepare ye the way of the Lord, make his path straight." John did baptize in the wilderness and preached the baptism of repentance for the remission of sins. And there went out unto him all the land of Judea and they of Jerusalem, and were all baptized of him in the river of Jordan, confessing their sins. And John was clothed with camel's hair and with a girdle of skin about his loins, and he did eat locusts and wild honey, and preaching, saying, "There cometh one mightier than I after me, whose latchets of whose shoes I am not worthy to stoop down and unloose. I indeed have baptized you with water, but he shall baptize you with the Holy Ghost." And it came to pass in those days that Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee, and was baptized of John in Jordan. And straightway coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens open, and the Spirit like a dove descending upon him. And there came a voice from the heavens, saying, "Thou art my beloved Son, of whom I am well pleased." And immediately the Spirit driveth him into the wilderness. And he was there in the wilderness 40 days, tempted of Satan, and was with the wild beast, and the angels ministered unto him. Gospel of Mark, chapter 1, verses 1 through 13. Okay, tonight we're going to take a look at the birth of a nation. Anybody who would like to follow along and read through this. And by the way, well, a couple of things before we start that. If anybody wants to get into the queue early, star 6 and a 1, got one person in the queue right now, so anybody wants to get into that queue, star 6 and a 1. We'll be taking some questions or comments after we take a look at the birth of a nation. Anybody would like to follow along, you can get up onto nationallibertyalliances.org, nationallibertyalliance.org, and on the front page, just come down a wee bit, not too far, a few paragraphs, and you'll see the truth about Thomas Jefferson. This is the birth of a nation, but it also is the truth about Thomas Jefferson. A lot of what you're going to hear tonight, most people have never even heard before. At least I know I hadn't until I discovered it, and I hadn't met anyone who really knew about this, all these things that we're going to look at tonight concerning Thomas Jefferson. One other thing, looks like I'm here alone tonight. I know Jan's away, Terry's away, so I'm the only moderator here on the channel at the moment. I don't know if anyone else come in shortly. But should I, I have problems sometimes staying connected. It seems about this time every Monday, I've been getting disconnected. I've been trying different things to prevent that from happening. hopefully tonight I'm not going to get disconnected. But if I do, I should return pretty quickly and just reboot some things and come back on again. I know last week it went pretty good with some of the things I've been doing now. I didn't get knocked off last week, so we'll see how things go right now. Okay, so again, The Birth of a Nation, but if you want to read along with this, you can find a PDF copy of this on nationallibertyalliance.org, The Truth About Thomas Jefferson. It's about five paragraphs down, and you should find the PDF there. The Birth of a Nation, Under God, The Declaration of Independence, America's Foundation. On June 11, 1776, Thomas Jefferson was appointed to a five-man committee alongside John Adams, Roger Sherman, Benjamin Franklin, and Robert R. Livingston, and was charged with drafting a formal statement justifying the break with Great Britain. The other members of the committee unanimously pressed on Thomas Jefferson alone to undertake the draft. Jefferson consented and drew it. Before Jefferson reported it to the committee, he communicated it separately to Dr. Franklin and Mr. Adams, requesting their corrections, and then wrote a fair copy, reported it to the committee, and from them, unaltered, to the Congress. James Madison wrote the initial draft of the Constitution called the Virginia Plan. Modifications were made to it at the Constitutional Convention by 55 delegates, presided over by George Washington. James Madison was one of the many delegates who wrote the Bill of Rights. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were more than good friends. These two Virginians and founding fathers participated in what was probably the greatest political collaboration in American history. Indeed, the history of the early republic is incomprehensible without an understanding of this political partnership. As John Quincy Adams once observed, the mutual influence of these two mighty minds upon each other is a phenomenon like the invisible and mysterious movements of a magnet in the physical world, and in which the sagacity of the future historians may discover the solution of much of our national history not otherwise easily accountable. The credit for giving an idea to bringing about amendments goes to George Madison, and he is popularly called the father of the Bill of Rights. He is known to have convinced Madison to write the bill following the often bitter 1787 and 88 debate over ratification of the U.S. Constitution. The Bill of Rights was written to address the objection raised by anti-federalists. The Bill of Rights amendments added to the Constitution specific guarantees of personal freedoms and rights, clear limitations on the government power in judicial and other proceedings, and explicit declarations that all powers not specifically delegated to Congress by this Constitution are reserved for the states or the people. The concepts codified in these amendments are built upon those found in several earlier documents, including the Virginia Declaration of Rights and the English Bill of Rights, along with earlier documents such as the Magna Carta, 1215. The Declaration of Independence is the foundation of American law. The Constitution is the framework of American law, and the Bill of Rights is the capstone of American law. These three founding documents collectively express American law and defines who we are as a people, setting us apart from any other republic. A republican form of government is a government that functions under law via a constitution. The difference between our American republic and any other republic is that we, the people, ordained and established our constitution in light of natural law. It is impossible to read and study our founders and the founding documents and not be instructed in God's law. This is our heritage, so long as we discern it and teach our children the same. If we, the people, neglect to identify with our founding fathers and their instructions, the founding documents, in law, we will lose the blessings of liberty and become like any other godless republic destined to be ruled by despots. For if we are not ruled by God, we will be ruled by men. The people have forgotten who they are and where they came from, and it is therefore no surprise that our elected and appointed servants have also. It is the duty of those who come to an understanding of these things to revive liberty's flame and spread the knowledge of this truth. America was founded upon 8 ancient principles. The man who discovered America's freedom formula, Thomas Jefferson. It is doubtful that any of the founders could have brought to this assignment a more profound and comprehensive training in history and political philosophy than Thomas Jefferson. Even by modern standards, the depth and breadth of his education are astounding. Here is a summary of his background. Jefferson had begun the study of Latin, Greek, and French at the age of 9. At the age of 16, he had entered the College of William and Mary at Williamsburg as an advanced student. At the age of 19, he had graduated and immediately commenced 5 years of intense study with George Wythe, the first professor of law in America. During this period, he often studied 12 to 14 hours per day. When he was examined for the bar, he seemed to know more than the men who were giving him the examination. By the time Jefferson had reached early adulthood, he had gained proficiency in 5 languages. He had studied the Greek and Roman classics. He had studied European and English history. He had carefully studied both the Old and New Testament. While studying the history of ancient Israel, Jefferson made a significant discovery. He saw that at one time the Israelites had practiced the earliest and most efficient form of representative government. As long as the Israelites followed their fixed pattern of constitutional principles, they flourished. When they drifted from it, disaster overtook them. Jefferson thereafter referred to this constitutional pattern as the ancient principles. Jefferson was also surprised to find that the Anglo-Saxons somehow had gotten a hold of some of these ancient principles and followed a pattern almost identical to that of the Israelites until around the 8th century A.D. It is interesting that when Jefferson was writing his draft for the Virginian Constitution, he was already emphasizing the need to return to the ancient principles. For 17 days, Jefferson composed and revised his rough draft of the Declaration of Independence. The major portion of the Declaration is taken up with a long series of charges against King George III. However, these were nearly all copied from Jefferson's draft of the Virginia Constitution and his summary view of the rights of the British America. To copy these charges into the Declaration would not have taken him more than a single day. What was he doing the other 16 days? It appears that he spent most of the remaining time trying to structure into the first 2 paragraphs at least 8 of the ancient principles, which he had come to admire. His view on each of these principles are rounded out in other writings and from these various sources. We are able to identify the following fundamental principles in the first 2 paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence. Sound government should be based on 8 self-evident truths. These truths should be so observed, so rational, so morally sound, that their authenticity is beyond reasonable dispute. The equal stations of mankind here on earth is a cosmic reality, an obvious and inherent aspect of the law of nature and of nature's God. This presupposes, as a self-evident truth, that the Creator made human beings equal in their rights, equal before the bar of justice, and equal in his sight. Of course, individual attributes and personal circumstances in life vary widely. These rights, which have been bestowed by the Creator on each individual, are unalienable. That is, they cannot be taken away or violated without the offender coming upon the judgment and the wrath of the Creator. A person may have other rights, such as those which have been created as a vested right by a statute, but vested rights are not unalienable. Our 3 branches of government have vested rights. They can be altered or eliminated at any time. Writing the Declaration of Independence, among the most important of the unalienable rights are the right of life and the right to liberty, and the right to pursue whatever course of life a person may desire in search of happiness, so long as it does not invade the inherent rights of others. The most basic reason for the community of a nation to set up a system of government is to assure its inhabitants that the rights of the people shall be protected and preserved. And because this is so, it follows that no office or agency or government has any right to exist except with the consent of the people or their representatives. It also follows that if government, either by malfeasance or neglect, fails to protect those rights, or even worse, if the government itself begins to violate those rights, then it is the right and the duty of the people to regain control of their affairs and set up a form of government which will serve the people better. The United States Constitution's prime directive, framed upon the 8 ancient principles, the preamble. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. The Supreme Law of the Land, Article 6, Clause 2. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. Bounded by oath, Article 6, Clause 2, the senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislators and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support the Constitution. The purpose of a written Constitution is entirely defeated if, in interpreting it as a legal document, its provisions are manipulated and worked around so that the document means whatever the manipulator wish. Jefferson recognized this danger and spoke out constantly for careful adherence to the Constitution as written, with changes to be made by amendment, not by tortured and twisted interpretations of the text. Jefferson on slavery. If you want to destroy the heart and soul of America, you must first assassinate the reputation of Thomas Jefferson, without which there would be no America. Ever since I can remember, I've heard destructive statements such as Jefferson's remarkable declaration was an enigma. Warren Throckmorton, an associate professor of psychology and co-author with Dr. Michael Coulter of Getting Jefferson Right, wrote, "Jefferson proclaimed that all men were created equal and possessed natural rights. However, as Jefferson wrote these words, he owned slaves, whose natural rights were not respected nor protected." Not long after he wrote the Declaration of Independence, his views on race became the basis for the movement to deport freed blacks to Africa or the West Indies. Jefferson bought and sold slaves throughout his adult life. He even sent bounty hunters after runaway slaves. Some Christian writers, such as David Barton, claimed that Virginian law prevented Jefferson from freeing his slaves. However, this is not true. Lies, 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 lies. And let us not forget these people's most useful tool, claiming sexual deviancy against their victims. You can find a powerful argument in support of Jefferson's character and a witness as to where these lies came from by the people who knew Jefferson in the book The Real Thomas Jefferson, chapter 18, titled A Season of Slander. And it seems that every documentary and historian seems to regurgitate the lies. These people are enemies of America, determined to destroy the heart and soul of America. We know this to be true because it is impossible to research Jefferson and not see how he struggled at every opportunity in his career to legalize emancipation in Virginia and extinguish slavery in America. He also stated that America will suffer the consequences of this sin at some future time. And so we have. The following are some excerpts from the book The Real Thomas Jefferson, chapter 18, titled A Season of Slander. The Republican administration, despite its popularity with the masses, was subjected to a steady barrage of criticism by the Federalists, pressed throughout Jefferson's two terms. The vilest attack on the president himself, however, came from an unexpected source. Calandra's Calamities. One of the victims of the Sedition Act, who was pardoned by President Jefferson in 1801, was James Thomason Calandra, a Republican journalist who had been an unrelenting critic of the Federalists during the last presidential campaign. But Calandra wanted more than a pardon. Later that year, he plainly told James Madison, the new Secretary of State, that he hoped to be appointed postmaster in Richmond, Virginia. When it became clear that he was not going to be offered any government post, the embittered calenderer sought revenge by going to work for the Federalist newspaper in Richmond. In March 1802, he began publishing various charges against Republican leaders in Congress and certain members of the cabinet. By autumn, he was training his guns on the president. Calenderer has been described as the most unscrupulous scandalmonger of the day, a journalist who stopped at nothing and stooped to anything. He was not an investigative journalist. He never bothered to investigate anything. For him, the story, especially if it reeked of scandal, was everything. Truth, if it stood in his way, was similarly mowed down. True to his style, he fabricated a series of scandalous stories about Jefferson's personal life, the ugliest of which charged him of having fathered several children by a mulatto slave at Monticello, a young woman named Sally Hemings. Although Calenderer, who had never gone near Jefferson's estate, he alleged that this was common knowledge in a neighboring area. He included many lewd details of this supposed illicit relationship. Among the entertaining facts he created for his readers, even inventing the names of children whom Dusky Sally had never born. Other Federalist editors took up these accusations with glee, and Calenderer's stories spread like wildfire from one end of the country to the other, sometimes expanded and embellished by sequent writers. The president was charged with other evils as well. The torrent of slander never seemed to let up. As one biographer had written, he suffered open personal attacks which in severity and obscenity have rarely, if ever, been matched in presidential history in the United States. Why are these liberals allowed? Like other men, Jefferson was sensitive to these false accusations. Years earlier, he had written, "My great wish is to go on in a strict but silent performance of my duty, to avoid attracting notice and to keep my name out of the newspapers, because I find the plain of a little censor, even when it is unfounded, is more acute than the pleasure of much praise." Even before entering the presidency, he felt he was being used as the property of the newspapers, a fair mark for every man's dirt. And now that he was subjected almost daily to fresh doses of venom from the Federalist penmen, he sorely lamented the malignant perversions of those who make every word from me a text for a new misrepresentation and calamities. Publicly, however, he made no response to these unscrupulous attacks. "I should have fancied myself half guilty," he said, "had I condescended to put pen to paper in refutation of their falsehoods, or drawn to them respect by any notice from myself." Nor did he use the channels of civil authority to silence his accusers. True to the declaration he had made in his inaugural address and elsewhere, he defended his countrymen's right to a free press. The Baron Alexander von Humboldt, a famous German explorer and scientist, learned the depth of Jefferson's commitment in this principle when he visited the city of Washington in the summer of 1804. Calling at the executive mansion one morning, Humboldt was invited to meet with the president in the cabinet room. As he sat by the table among the newspapers that were scattered about, he perceived one that was always filled with the most poisonous abuse of Mr. Jefferson. False accusations, the most offensive, personal as well as political. "Why are these liberals allowed?" asked the baron, taking up the paper. Why is it not this liberalist journal suppressed, or its editor at least fined and imprisoned?" Mr. Jefferson smiled, saying, "Put that paper in your pocket, Baron, and should you hear the reality of our liberty or the freedom of our press questioned in Europe, show this paper and tell where you found it." Jefferson's grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, described the calm perspective with which the president viewed these slanderers. In speaking of the calamities which his enemies had uttered against his public and private character with some unmitigated and untiring bitterness. He said that he had not considered them as abusing him. They had never known him. They have created an imaginary being clothed with odious attributes to whom they had given his name, and it was against that creature of their imaginations that they leveled their antisemitic or abominations. Not only did Jefferson remain silent about the sensational accusations of James Chandler and like-minded journalists, but he also instructed the members of his cabinet to do the same. The Federalist Press continued its harassment throughout Jefferson's presidency, but this unsavory effort lost much of its momentum after July 1803, the month Calandra drowned himself in the James River. In a conversation with a 19th century biographer, Henry Randall, Jefferson's oldest grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, confirmed that others close to the family had already disclosed that Sally Hemings was actually the mistress of Jefferson's nephew, Peter Carr, and that their connection was perfectly notorious at Monticello. Thomas Jefferson was born to a slave-owning family. In 1767, at age 24, Jefferson inherited 5,000 acres of land and 52 slaves from his father. In 1774, Jefferson inherited 2 plantations and 135 more slaves from his father-in-law, John Wales, who had been directly involved in the importation of enslaved Africans into Virginia. This practice was not forbidden until 1778 by an act drafted by Jefferson himself. As chairman of the committee that drafted the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson wrote a paragraph condemning slavery in his first draft of the Declaration. He included this paragraph in his list of complaints against King George III. Before the final version of the Declaration was adopted, this paragraph was deleted. He said, "He, King George III, has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life, liberty, in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating, carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian king of Great Britain, determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold. He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to forbid or to restrain this execrable commerce." Thomas Jefferson later stated, "My opinion has never been that until more can be done for them, we should endeavor with those whose fortune has thrown in on our hands to feed and clothe them, well protect them from ill usage, require such reasonable labor only as to be performed voluntarily by freemen, and be led by no repugnancies to abdicate them and our duties to them. Nothing would induce me to put my Negroes out of my protection." Jefferson wrote in 1820. Like many of his contemporaries in Virginia, he held parentalistic views of his human property, feeling responsible for their welfare, while doubting their ability to succeed in a free white world. Jefferson had strong scruples against selling slaves while freeing persons whose habits have been formed in slavery, he said, is like abandoning children. Jefferson's character had to be destroyed in order for the New World Order that was already entrenched in the creation of our government as early as 1776 to take a foothold, and by 1792, Hamilton, who already had strong ties to the foreign bankers, was already advocating for a national bank, at which time Jefferson saw Hamilton as a threat to liberty because he knew that a central bank would destroy America. And it was likely that the foreign bankers, already chomping at the bit, started the aforesaid season of slander against Jefferson when he became president. It was Jefferson who discovered America's freedom formula. He rediscovered natural law, also known as common law, and the government structure we have today. Jefferson, serving as minister to France and was out of the country during the Constitutional Convention, and the writings of the Anti-Federalist Papers that resulted in the Bill of Rights, and corresponded with James Madison concerning the same. Anti-Federalists opposed the creation of a stronger U.S. federal government, and which later opposed the ratification of the 1787 Constitution. The previous Constitution, called the Articles of Confederation, gave state government more authority. Led by Patrick Henry of Virginia, Anti-Federalists worried about, among other things, that the position of president, then a novelty, might evolve into a monarchy. Though the Constitution was ratified and supplanted the Articles of Confederation, Anti-Federalist influence helped led to the passage of the United States Bill of Rights, where we read in the preamble, "The conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adoption the Constitution expressed the desire, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its power, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the grounds of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institution." On December 7th, 1787, five states, Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Georgia, and Connecticut, ratified it in quick session. However, other states, especially Massachusetts, opposed the document, as it failed to reserve undelegated powers to the state and lacked constitutional protection of basic political rights, such as freedom of speech, religion, and the press. In February 1788, a compromise was reached under which Massachusetts and other states would agree to ratify the document with the assurance that amendments would be immediately proposed. The Constitution was thus narrowly ratified in Massachusetts, followed by Maryland, South Carolina. On June 21, 1788, New Hampshire became the ninth state to ratify the document, and it was subsequently agreed that government under the U.S. Constitution would begin on March 4, 1789. In June, Virginia ratified the Constitution, followed by New York in July. On September 25, 1789, the First Congress of the United States adopted 12 amendments to the United States Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and sent them to the states for ratification. 10 of these amendments were ratified in 1791. In November of 1789, North Carolina became the 12th state to ratify the U.S. Constitution. Rhode Island, which opposed federal control of currency and was critical of compromise on the issue of slavery, resisted ratifying the Constitution until the United States government threatened to sever commercial relationship with the state. On May 29, 1790, Rhode Island voted by two votes to ratify the document, and the last of the original 13 colonies joined the United States. Today, the U.S. Constitution is the oldest written constitution in operation in the world. The first act of Jefferson's political career, as noted earlier, was an attempt to make it legal for slave owners in Virginia to emancipate their slaves. That bill was rejected, as was the condemnation of slavery in his original draft of the Declaration of Independence. His labors on this course finally met with some success in 1778 when he introduced a bill in Virginia House of Delegates to prevent the further importation of slaves into the state. The proposal was approved, but he recognized that it only stopped the increase of the evil by importation, leaving to future efforts its final eradication. It was Jefferson's desire to open the way for this final eradication. The very next year, when his committee submitted their proposal for the revision of Virginia's legal code. However, he ascertained through conversations with his colleagues that the legislature was not yet prepared to consider such a progressive step, so he calculated another strategy. The bill on the subject of slaves was mere digest in the existing law respecting them, without any intimation of a plan for the future and general emancipation. It was thought better that this should be kept back and attempted only by way of amendment whenever the bill should be brought on. But when the bill did not come up for debate, Jefferson was unable to get his amendment passed. It was founded that the public mind would not yet bear the proposition. yet the day is not distant when it must bear and adopt it. He wrote, or worse will follow. Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people are to be free. Jefferson would be heard from again on the issue of slavery. The vast area between the Appalachians and the Mississippi River had long been claimed by several of the original states, but the recent cession of these claims placed the area under the control of Congress in early 1784. Jefferson was appointed chairman of a committee to settle the many land disputes which had risen and to prepare a plan for the government for this western region. Jefferson himself drafted the report, known to history as the Ordinance of 1784. According to one scholar, the plan ranks second in importance only to the Declaration of Independence. Among Jefferson's state papers, this document, which reprinted together with preliminary drafts in Boyd 6-6-0-3-15, became the basis for the famous Northwest Ordinance of 1787. It provided for the creation of self-governing territories that would eventually be admitted into the Union on terms of full equality with the original states. It was a bold and brilliant concept, one that would ultimately have a tremendous influence on the westward expansion of the United States. But Congress rejected a very significant element in Jefferson's report on the Western territories. He had included in the bill a clause barring slavery in any of these territories after the year of 1800, a measure which might have averted the Civil War, but this proposal was defeated by one vote, and Jefferson lamented, "The voice of a single individual would have prevented this abominable crime from spreading itself over the new country. Thus we see the fate of millions unborn hanging on the tongue of one man, and heaven was silent in that awful moment. But it is to be hoped it will not always be silent, and that the friends to the rights of human nature will, in the end, prevail." Yet Jefferson worried about what might have to take place before this victory for the rights of human nature could be secured. Jefferson had actually advocated this idea 8 years earlier. His proposed new Virginian Constitution contained a provision that any future colonies established from Virginia's western domain would be free and independent of this colony and of all the world. Jefferson stated, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that his justice cannot sleep forever, that considering numbers, nature, and natural means only, a revolution of the wheel of fortune, an exchange of situation, is among possible events, and that it may become probable by supernatural interference. The Almighty has no attributes which can take side with us in such a contest." Always an optimist, in the end, however, Jefferson noted the next year that the cause of emancipation was gaining daily recruits from the influx into the office of young men grown and growing up. These have sucked in the principles of liberty, as it were, with their mother's milk, and it is to them I look with anxiety to turn the fate of this question. The theory of government borrowed from John Locke holds that the only purpose of government and its only competence is to protect private property. If it presumes to go beyond that function, it is guilty of misfeasance. If it fails to perform that function, it is derelict of its duty. In the Federalist Papers, number 10, Madison writes, "The first object of government is the protection of the diversity in the facilities of men from which the rights of private property originate." From that theory, despite their willingness to make compromises, the Founding Fathers never deviated. Jefferson said, "Common sense is the foundation of all authorities of the laws themselves and of their construction. The Constitution on which our Union rests shall be administered by me, as President, according to the safe and honest meanings contemplated by the plain understanding of the people of the United States at the time of its adoption, a meaning to be found in the explanations of those who advocate it, not those who oppose it, and who oppose it merely lest the construction should be applied which they denounced as possible. I do then with sincere zeal wish an inviolable preservation of our present federal constitution according to the true sense in which it was adopted by the states, that in which it was advocated by its friends, and not that which its enemies apprehended, who therefore became its enemies. Where powers are assumed which have not been delegated, a nullification of the act is the rightful remedy. The states alone, being parties to the federal compact, are solely authorized to judge in the last resource of the powers exercised under it. Congress, being not a party but merely the creation of the compact, and subject as to its assumptions of power to the final judgment of those by whom and for whose use itself and its powers were all created and modified. The government created by this compact was not made the exclusive or final judge of the extent of its powers delegated to itself, since that would have made its discretion and not the Constitution the measure of its powers. But, as in all other cases of compact among powers having no common judge, each party has an equal right to judge for itself, as well as infractions, as of the made and measures of redress, of the mode and measures of redress. In Federalist Paper number 45, Madison writes, "The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which remain in the states' governments are numerous and indefinite. The former will be exercised principally on external objects, as war, peace, negotiations, and foreign commerce, with which last part of powers of taxation will, for the most part, be connected. The powers reserved to the several states will extend to all the objects which in the ordinary course of affairs concerns and lives and liberties and properties of the people and the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. The operations of the federal government will be most extensive in times of war and danger. Those of the states' governments in times of peace and security, as the former periods will probably bear a small proportion to the latter. The state governments will here enjoy another advantage over the federal government." Once the Constitution was written, it needed to be approved by the states to become law. Many state delegates worried that even with the concept of federation and dual sovereignty in the document, it was still too ambiguous and could someday be interpreted to give the federal government too much power. To calm these fears, the Bill of Rights was added to the further limit of the federal scope. All of these checks were needed because the federal government will never check its own power. If left unattended, as the people have done via the constitutional ignorance, it will naturally move towards centralization to enhance its own authority. That is why the founders created a federal system of government based on dual sovereignty, along with the Bill of Rights, to place as much power as possible into the hands of the states and the people. That is also why it is so important for the states to assert their sovereignty and question or resist federal laws that they believe are unconstitutional. Thomas Jefferson believed that the most important protector of individual liberty was the support of the state governments in their rights, as the most competent administrations for our domestic concerns, and the surest bulwarks against anti-republican tendencies. Without states' rights, the people are no longer sovereign. When this happens, the federal government becomes the master, not the servant, of the people. This is exactly what our founding fathers worked so hard to prevent via the Bill of Rights, where we read again, "The conventions of a number of the states having at the time of their adoption of the Constitution expressed a desire, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the grounds of the public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficent ends of its institutions." The Anti-Federalists believed in more rights for the individual than for the state, asserted that the biggest threat to freedom was a powerful federal government. They believed that even the balance of power between the three branches of government was not enough to prevent the government from becoming tyrannical. These works played an important role in the passage of the U.S. Bill of Rights that were proposed following the often bitter 1787-88 debate over ratification of the United States Constitution and written to address the objections raised by the Anti-Federalists. The Bill of Rights amendments add to the Constitution specific guarantees of personal freedom and rights, clear limitations on the government power in judicial and other proceedings, and explicit declarations that all power not specifically delegated to the Congress by the Constitution are reserved for the states or the people. The concept codified in these amendments are built upon those found in several earlier documents, including the Virginia Declaration of Rights and the English Bill of Rights, along with earlier documents such as Magna Carta. The Constitution lists the powers, restrictions, and elections of government representatives, generally speaking, and as Jefferson said, laws are made for men of ordinary understanding and should therefore be construed by the ordinary rules of common sense. Their meaning is not to be sought for in metaphysical subtleties which may make anything mean everything or nothing at pleasure. In conclusion, upon the exiting of the Constitutional Convention, Benjamin Franklin was approached by a group of citizens asking, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" He responded, "A republic, if you can keep it." James Madison said, "A well-instructed people alone can be permanently a free people." Samuel Adams said, "The natural liberty of man is to be free from any superior power on earth, and not to be under the will of legislative authority of men, but only to have the laws of nature for his rule." And Thomas Jefferson said, "How little do my countrymen know what precious blessings they are in possession of, and which no other people on earth enjoy. But when injustice becomes law, resistance becomes duty." Okay. Before we get started, by the way, there's only one person in the queue, so if anybody wants to get into the queue, *6 and a 1. And again, it looks like I'm the only monitor on this channel at the moment, and I know Jan's away, and Terry's away. I don't see that Brent is here tonight, but I'll keep an eye open for him as best I can. and I know Gerard's been running through a lot of problems, so he hasn't been here for quite some time. So, again, I'm the only monitor on this thing. If I should disappear for a moment or two, you know, I'll be back because I do have some problems over the past months being disconnected around this time. But I know last month some of the things I've been doing trying to beat that out, I wasn't disconnected last week. So hopefully I'm not going to get disconnected this week. So anyway, bear with things should I disappear for a short. All right, again, only a couple people in the queue, *6 and a 1 to get into the queue. Before we get started, just want to make a note. I've been working diligently this past weekend and the week before, during the week, and this particularly the weekend, on the papers that we're going to be filing in the federal courts. Things are really starting to heat up in Washington and ultimately around the world, really. And there's anticipation on some big exposures this coming week or possibly next week. So a lot of things are going to break and things are going to happen. And the timing for the filing of our papers would be very good to happen at the right time when these things start breaking. So I started to put all of my energies and focus in on finishing this paper up. Now, I do have the paper up. It's about 40-some-odd pages at the moment. I think it's going to be around 50. I don't want it really to go much over 50. It becomes a long read. But it is a long read, and it's got to be a long read. And I know I could have written hundreds of pages. But that was the most difficult part, is trying to figure out what really needs to be said. And as much as I might want to say, well, I kept it at a minimum, it appears quite large anyway. But anyway, I think it's an exciting read. I got the structure already done. I've got a lot of basic information that I plan to get into in there already. So I got the whole layout done. And I finished that up earlier today. So now I'm going to be going through cleaning it up and making sure that everything harmonizes well, that comes out maybe in a proper order, which is one of the most hardest things because there's a lot to be said, but the question is, you know, how to put these things into order and maintain some kind of a flow, a logical flow, and focus on what this thing is all about. I think we've got a very powerful paper. I really do believe that, extremely powerful. We're going to be doing some extraordinary things, and I think we could say that pretty much everything we're planning on doing to really get some momentum, power, and authority in this paper has already been done, but never in it has never been done in the series of all the things necessary to do what we're trying to do at one shot. So we do have a lot to rest on in history and in the way things work in courts, and the way our nation was put together and what our law actually is. You know, Samuel Adams put it, you know, the natural liberty of man is to be free from any superior power on earth. People are responsible for their own behavior. We do not need legislators to try to control our behavior. And he went on to say, and not to be under the will of the legislative authorities of man. So they are not to legislate anything in any way, shape, or form concerning our behavior. And he also went on and finished to say, but only to have the law of nature for his rule. So we are under the laws of nature. We're not under the legislation of men. The federal government has no power, no authority to be able to write anything that controls our behavior in any way, shape, or form. Of the 57 U.S. titles that they have written, they have focused, of course, you know, this is part of the conspiracy and part of the problems, and again, it goes back to ignorance. This happens because we, the people, are ignorant. We need to become educated in these things. But in any event, they've written the penal code in U.S. C. Title 18, which is the law of the sea, ultimately. And we do cover these things in the paper that we're writing. The other thing that is applied upon us is the rules of the court, which is U.S. C. 28. And so Title 28 really are the rules of procedure, the rules of evidence, the rules of the court, and the notorious Rule 12, which these judges use on a daily basis to throw anyone that is not a lawyer or has a lawyer out of the court. And so again, that's in under Rule 20, under U.S.C. 28. The other title that is used against we the people is U.S.C. Title 26, which we know is the tax code, which is just nothing but mumbo jumbo. It is so no one could understand what they're even talking about. It really is that bad. And but yet you don't have to dig too deep to discover that the authority they claim over you is not available for them to have. Also, U.S.C. 26 is not law. It says so within it. It is not positive law. It is not listed as positive law. It's administrative law at best. But it claims also within inside itself to be a court of record, which claims to be under, therefore, the law of the land, in other words, under natural law. That makes it a contradiction because the moment you move into statutes, you've just moved away from common law. In common law, there are no statutes, none whatsoever. A lot of the rules of procedure and the rules of a way a court process should go as far as evidence, the rules of evidence and so on, a lot of it is kind of logical, and there's really no debate or argument about a lot of these things in the sense of 28. It was put together in order to have a process in the court so that things proceed in a proper fashion. But in any event, rules are not to be applied upon us. We can deny and argue them. Again, there are certain things that are obvious. For instance, you know, when you, if you take up a paper to bring a lawsuit against someone, for instance, you have to serve that person, and it's got to be very reasonable that you know you could prove that yes, we served this person, they didn't show up, therefore we're going to run them into fault. So I mean, certain things are obvious, but nevertheless, there are major problems in the rules of the court under USC 28. Let me see, just a quick, all right, well, anyway, those are the things or the problems that, you know, really are plaguing us. They have no authority to in any way to write any legislation to control our behavior. And again, anything in 18, USC 18, that they claim is the penal code, doesn't apply. It's outside, and it says it very clearly inside. And I, you know, this is how bad and how ignorant even the lawyers are. Maybe some smart lawyers pick up on it and try to run it through the courtroom, but I'm sure they're quickly pulled into the back room and let known that don't bring that up in the court again. And this makes it a conspiracy. This could not happen without being a conspiracy, and it's a conspiracy between past legislators, past administrations, and of course past Supreme Court justices and district court judges, the federal judges. They have to work together to do this, and even with ignorance and saying, well, okay, fine, you know, this took place way back when, and it, you know, 50 years or 60 years now, probably at least, that these conspiracy is being exercised upon we the people, and yet, you know, we the judges continue under this. What would we even call it? De facto court with no power, no authority, no law, nothing behind it. So we do know that the federal judges know. They're highly educated. They understand the titles. They know the difference between the jurisdictions as they walk between the jurisdictions and arguments in a court. One lawyer put it this way, you know, when you walk into a federal district court and you start to talk, the jurisdictions change as the conversation moves forward. So it can get quite complicated, and anybody who's not schooled in those titles and is trying to argue cases under those titles, going to have some big problems there. As for we the people, you know, we have no need to know and understand the legislative laws in these titles. They have applications towards different things. For instance, Title IV is law written, and this is actual positive law concerning the flag, the seal, the seat of government, and the states. Title 26, for instance, is on Homeland Security. And by the way, that which is upon Homeland Security is not positive law. It's administrative law. So a lot of these things are regulations. They're codes and statutes and regulations to control the federal government in itself or all of the different agencies. Title 1 is general provisions. Title 2 is Congress. Title 3 is the statutes concerning the control of the president, and it goes on and on. Title 14 is the Coast Guard. Title 21 is food and drugs. Title 35 is patents. Title 45 is railroads, and 46 is shipping. 56 is wildlife. 57 is small business. So they're all very well-needed law to control the processes that we gave our servants in federal government to exercise. And so the titles are not bad, okay, until they're used against we the people. Then it becomes a problem. We take this off into the states also, the same thing. The federal government has no power authority to legislate our behavior. Well, neither does the state. Neither does the county. Neither do towns, village courts, any of these places. All these places that try to legislate and control our behavior and ultimately make money out of, because that's what it's all about, That's why you have all these court systems throughout the whole nation. Every town, it seems, wants, and they don't have every town, but every town seems to want a court. And in order to have a court, they have to have town police, and they go through the whole process, and they have to, and they want to generate money. So as people travel through their town, you know, they can violate them with different codes and make some money. It's nothing but a money machine. That's all it is. And it's an assault upon liberty. It's assault upon the Constitution. It's assault upon we, the people. So anyway, so we have put together a really rock solid, I think, a good paper. We got a small committee coming together. I'm going to try to connect to maybe later this week. And I think I'm going to get the paper done this week. I do believe that that's probably the case. I mean, it's there. It's really just trying to put it together now and making sure it runs smooth and you know, doesn't trip over itself as you go through this and has a logical approach and a flow so that it is clear to those who will be going after, which is the federal government, particularly Congress, both houses, and the judiciary, starting from the United States Supreme Court and all of the federal court judges in all 94 federal districts. We're going to pull together a committee. I'm not sure when some of the people that are away are going to get back, Jan, Terry, and others. So hopefully they'll be back by the end of the week or next week, and then pull that committee together to go through the paper and kind of finalize it, clean it up, check out the flow, make sure there's no redundancies, and so on and so forth. Anything we may miss or maybe something that we shouldn't have in there, but I don't think that's the case of anything. I think everything that's in there is really needed. And again, this could be hundreds of pages, but we had to reduce it. We're going to make reference to memorandums that we've written. I'm going to go back through all the memorandums that we've written. We've got about 20 or more, and there are a few others that we haven't really posted yet that just aren't completed, and I'm going to go see what the importance of getting those memorandums done, and if so, get them done, and hopefully we'll get them just cleaned up maybe by the end of the next week or two. And those will be filed into court along with a tremendous amount of evidence. And we do have a place where we've been archiving all of our paperwork in the court up in the Northern District under a federal case number that we've been filing under and we continue to file under. And we're going to file this case under that number also, but with a very unique twist to it, which we're not going to talk about it until we release it. But we're going to have, there's a tremendous amount of evidence that we're going to post up there, memorandums and different things. And also we have filed, probably 100 papers that we've written and to all of our servants at every level, at least down to the state level, nothing further than that. You know, the governor, the legislative bodies, and the counties as far as judges are concerned. So we've got a lot to post up there. But we're not going to be serving all those papers. We're going to make reference to its location where it has been filed. To some degree, as a matter of fact, all of these papers have been already served on these people. We used to have, for those who didn't know, we used to have about 10 fax machines that were running 24/7 for a long time. So we have been posting. We have not only been filing these papers in the court, we've been serving them on everyone. Every sheriff in this country has been receiving papers or had been receiving papers. Every governor, both houses of every state, and, of course, everyone on the federal level. All federal district courts, they're all aware of us. They've all received lots of our paperwork over a period of time. We're not exercising or executing faxes anymore. And the main reason for that, ultimately, is just we just don't have enough money to keep that going. You know, if one day we start to get some more money where we can do that kind of thing, we'll go back to that, because I think that was an important part of what we were doing. It didn't matter that they ignored us. It didn't matter that they didn't understand it. It didn't matter that they may have passed it off to a lawyer because they don't know what to think of it. Well, all of that is irrelevant. The fact that the information was flowing, the fact that they've been served, the fact that they have remained silent and ignored it is really a conviction on them to begin with. But not only that, you know, I'm sure they read pieces of it, and especially the secretaries and the clerks. I'm sure they're the ones that probably read the things, and they're the ones that probably understand it, because, again, it's written for the common person. It's written in plain language. It's our founding documents, is who we are as a people, what common law is all about. It's all just logical and obvious, and it's history. It's our founding fathers' statements, quotes concerning, you know, who we are and what we are as a people and war and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's not a difficult read at all. It's an exciting read, in my opinion. It's an empowering read. Anybody who reads it will be empowered by it, guaranteed you'll be empowered. And I think hopefully uplifted and a good feeling about who we are as a people, as Americans, about our founding fathers and so on and so forth. So again, timing is coming. It's going to happen any time now. We are so close to having this finished that within the next week or two at the most, it will be served. There is a possibility of us retarding it a little longer should certain things not happen yet, because again, it's got to be amongst the turmoil, amongst the release of information concerning all of the evil that many of our quote-unquote servants have been exercising unbeknownst to most Americans. People are going to be shocked by some of the things that are going to be revealed, it's going to open up again soon and over time period. But that's when they know. And that's why it's important to file this paper at the right time, because that's when they're going to know there is no more protection. When the deep state is being taken down and they have no place to hide anymore, that's when this paper is going to have its most strongest effect. Now, this ultimately has been our plan from the beginning. Ultimately, we started serving papers in 2016. We've been working on this a lot longer than that, but our paper drive and movement was as we were seeing Mr. Trump becoming president and then becoming the president of the United States. That's when we started to really get excited, because we started to see as time goes on more and more. We kind of knew he knew what was going on anyway. We just didn't know how much. At least I didn't know how much he understood, but the more and more you listen to this guy and you follow along what he's doing and what Q is saying and so on, and all the reports and what's going on right now with the way he tweets against the squad, the most ridiculous group I don't even want to call them representatives, but that's what they are. They're representing something else. Certainly they're not representing their people. They're not representing us. They're not representing the Constitution. But all of this that's working out right now, we started to see that, and that's when we started to really move towards paper filing, because the past 2 years, longer than that, we have 2016, we started filing, 2017, 2018, and now we're into 2019. So our pressing of those filing of papers really have been encouraged and was kind of looking and hoping. You know, again, we didn't know how we were going to approach this prior to Trump. We didn't know we would get a Trump. I mean, he was a total surprise. No one saw this coming. But once he got in, we knew this is the day, this is the time. We knew that he had to take his time also. We knew that he had to accomplish certain things. He had to prepare the nation in certain ways. He had to fix the economy, get a relationship, take over the UN, take over the Federal Reserve, and so on and so on and so on and so on. I mean, he's got total control over everything. I mean, who would have thought this? I certainly wouldn't have. Far better than I ever could have perceived that it could have happened. And of course, it's not just one man, but he is the key guy. I don't know of anybody else that could have pulled off and exercised the things that he has done. But again, he's not by himself. He's got a huge team working with him. He's got the military behind him. Of course, he's got a good cabinet and a lot of other people, a lot of supporters, and even in Congress and even judges and so on. So, again, timing is perfect for us. Timing is perfect for the people. And I certainly hope everybody really gets focused in here, watching what's going on and getting ready to get behind this paper, to get this word out everywhere. And, you know, I'll just call out right now, again, anybody who will send out some papers for us, it's going to be about 50 papers. I don't think it's going to be more than that, but it's going to be around 50 papers. So it's not going to be a big thing. If you go out and buy one ream of paper, that's 250 pages, you know, papers in a ream. So that's at 50 apiece, that's five. You can print off five copies of this thing and send it to five places. We do want to serve them on all 94 federal district courts. We do want to, you know, I'm going to do all of the filings on a federal level, make sure everybody gets it up on the federal level. But we do want to get the governor served. We do want to get the legislative bodies and all states served. We want to get the sheriff served. And I don't know how many of those we are going to be able to do. And it depends on you. It depends on the people stepping up and putting their name down and saying, I'll do five. Or I'll do even two or one. But hopefully people step and say, I'll do five. Print off five. We'll tell you who to mail them to, how to fill out the return card on that, and send it out. I suspect it's going to cost probably $20. Okay, for each one. We'll figure that out, but I don't think it's much more than $20. But $20 for each one to serve. And so if individuals can do five, that's 20, 40, 60, 80, it's $100 plus maybe $20 for the paper and whatever toner you might use. So let's say it's a $125 investment to save your country, to save your nation, to save your state, to secure liberty for yourself and your posterity and for your neighbors and friends and for those who aren't even paying attention. That's not a big cost. It's a lot better to go out and fight this fight with paper than in other ways, using maybe the Second Amendment. And so we've got a great opportunity to do what we have to do, and we can do it hugely, and it could move quickly through the system. We could put the fear of the people and the fear of God into these people very quickly if we really press and forward on the serving. We also want to get out copies of this electronically or in hard copies to as many news places as possible. I do have quite a large listing of emails to many newspapers across this nation. If I recall, I think I got 1,000, a couple of thousand maybe even. I don't remember, but I think more than 1,000. I think maybe a couple of thousand. And I can get that out very quickly. I've got a program that can serve the mail out and get it done in a day. So getting information, we'll put together an introduction page, you know, and then attach a copy of the papers in. Also, we want to get out to as many of the different YouTube channels out there that are bringing out the news. We want to get copies to those people, okay? Well, we want to get interviewed by as many people as possible. And so this takes the people to help us. We need the people to help us to put that money investment in. And again, look, if you only can afford $30 or something, then do one. Just get your name, get a hold of Jan. Send them an email. Let them know you're in, jan@nationallibertyalliance.org. Or you can go to our directory on National Liberty Alliance, and you can look up his phone number. You can give him a call. He's towards the top. He's the national leader for National Liberty Alliance. But everybody needs to step up and do what they have to do to get this out there. Okay, so I'm kind of excited about this, and it's going to go out, and we do have a lot of papers we're going to be joining to this case, and we're going to be doing this in a very unique way. Again, it's going to be powerful. It's going to be something they can't ignore. It's going to be something overwhelming to them. It's going to be something that's going to worry them and concern them. And it's going to be something that's going to be received with great joy and glee to those who are in the system, who are love to see this nation brought back to where it belongs. So there, we do have good people still in government. They've just been silenced. They've had a gun to their head for a long time. And once that gun is removed from their head, they're going to be receiving this greatly, and they will be pushing it as much as we will to bring this nation back to where it needs to be, free and independent. Okay, with that, we'll take questions. We'll take our first caller. Let me see if Brent is here first, if he wants to speak for a while. I didn't see him in yet. Just going to take me a second to run through. Nope, I don't see him here. So it doesn't look like he's in the queue today. Okay, so we're just going to go to calls, questions, comments, statements, whatever. We'll take our first caller. 612 is our first caller. I don't have a name. Or what's your first name and your state? 612, area code. 998, 612. You got the mic. You were the first person in queue. One more time, 612-998. You got the mic. Maybe you've got yourself muted and you're talking. I don't know. You're not muted on our channel here. There you go. First name and state. How you doing? Go ahead. We got
you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so I had a question about foreclosure and filing with the court. This is the third.
Go ahead.
This is the third time that I've had to go to court for this. That this is the third non-judicial foreclosure that they've brought, and this time the bank was received the motion for summary judgment, but this time a non or a junior lien holder came into play, but the judgment that they use is a 290 judgment for someone else with a similar name, but it's not mine, and I have an affidavit showing that it's not mine, but and I filed a default entry against this company, but the court hasn't done anything yet. What steps do I need to take now? Do I need to file a default, a memorandum? I'm not sure what to do at this point.
Well, look, you know, I give people advice and ideas, and some people really are not qualified to do certain things, go forward, and they do things, and they kind of get themselves into more trouble. That's why we keep pushing an education here. And, you know, first you want to, if you know what you're doing and you understand how the system works, you want to challenge the jurisdiction. And you can go up to our page, you know, on National Liberty Alliance, and click on, let's see where you would go. Hang on a minute. Go up there and click on due process, and when you get to due process, read through that page, come down to the end, and click on the last button to get into that next page. You have to be a supporting member, someone giving $5 a month or more to get to that page. We've got a lot of information there, and we do have a paper in there. You can write your own. You can take the paper and pretty much use it the way it is, you know, put your own information in there for challenging jurisdiction. But you need to understand what to do next, okay? And we have all the paperwork to go to the next step, and the next step. But if people aren't really schooled in that area on how to go forward, you know, when they do something, you got to do something. If you're in a court and you discover that they are controlling the narrative and that you are on the defense, you're losing. You're losing. If you control the narrative and they are on the defense, you're winning. And you must be able to do that. The moment you discover that they have moved you over to the defense, you got to do something to get out of that, and you got to do it quickly. You got to make these people worry about you. And again, that takes knowledge. And it's not that it's a lot of knowledge. It could be learned relatively quickly, but you're not going to learn it in a weekend. You can get the gist of it in a weekend if you have a good, you know, idea on how things work there. So you can get the gist of it done in a weekend. But it still takes some time, a couple of months. But if you follow the paperwork very carefully and you do the step-by-step process that we've given out there, you know, each step gives you another 30 days because they need to respond to these things, and so you got to give them the 30 days to respond, and then you respond and do the next step. So each step could be 30, then another 30, then another. So you can get like 90 days out of this, and maybe even more. As a matter of fact, I know you can get more out of this. And meanwhile, during that 90 days, what are you doing? You need to be educating yourself. You need to be taking all of the courses that we have, the books that we wrote, everything that we have that's on that page. You need to be going through thoroughly. Now, the other thing, and I think the most powerful part, because, again, they're going to fight you tooth and nail, is to join your case with ours. If you want to join, there's one of the top things on the first page when you come in is a paper to fill out for. It's called to get a petition of joinder. So you fill out a form and get it to Jim. You know, there's an email address. Get it to Jim. And Jim will go through things, and he'll prepare the petition for joinder for your signature. He'll get that to you. You'll get it out in the mail, and then we'll move to the next step. We will do what's called an amicus curiae from the grand jury, which is coming in as a friend to you, who may be the defendant. Usually, a defendant. Of course, you're the defendant in this. So we come in as a friend of the court on behalf of the defendant, and we really basically challenge jurisdiction for you and move it forward for you to be restored back to your original state when this whole thing started. If they refuse to do that, then the next paper we file for you, and it's a series. You know, there's time. You know, we first file the first paper for you, and they got 30 days to do what has to be done. And then maybe 34, 35 days in, we then move the next paper in, which really is moving the case over to joinder, okay, where they now have to respond again. And so we have a series of papers. There's about three papers before we get to the end of the things. And I think when we get to the end of it, it's going to be very powerful. Because I think what we're doing is going to be very powerful, and it's connected to what we're doing with this paperwork that I've been speaking about. So it's all connected to this case that we're filing, and it's going to be all over the place. And again, they're going to also be finding that they're no longer protected, so these judges are going to get very nervous, and I think we're going to get a lot of justice. We're also preparing for lots of indictments for those who resist. So we have a nice plan, and this plan will be unfolded even greater once we do the filing. We'll get into much more detail on what's going on, and people, of course, read the case and be able to ask questions on that. And joining, you'll be able to continue joining as long as this case continues and goes. And people want to join. They can join right in, and we'll press the case for you to get restitution on this case and whatever your case may be. In this case, a non-judicial foreclosure.
Okay. And then when you say challenge jurisdiction, I'm doing that against the bank or against the parties, three parties?
Well, that tells me that you don't really understand enough to be able to do this on your own. You're going to want to join it and let us do it for you then. No, the jurisdiction is being challenged. The court does not have jurisdiction. Okay? Plus, not only do they not have jurisdiction over you, it's not a court of record. It's an equity court. An equity court runs by a judge, and they make summary judgments. That's not how a court of law works, okay? So as long as they're operating in an equity court, they're operating in a court unknown to you. You're in jurisdictions unknown, and they're making it up as they go, and they're applying statutes to you, and they're applying rules and things you don't even know about. So it's not a court that has any power or authority over you. And so we challenge that jurisdiction. We also make the point that they're denying you due process, because if you don't have that opportunity to go to court and be judged by peers on this situation, then you're not getting your due process. So they're not giving you that either. And these foreclosures, the reason why they do non-judicial foreclosures, because it's impossible. Let me repeat this. It's impossible for them to file a foreclosure in a court of law. They can't win. Okay? And there's numerous reasons for that, which we're not going to go into. A lot of people probably understand why they can't do that, but I don't want to get into those details right now. But they can't do it in a court of law. So they have to do it in a quasi de facto court of not record, operating in jurisdictions unknown. And once we close that down, they have no avenue to come out after you anymore. So the whole thing is a fraud.
Okay. Okay.
Right?
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. Move to the next person. Elaine is the next. Let me hit the button here. Elaine, you got the mic. Go right ahead. Anybody wants to get into the queue, star 601.
Hello, this is Elaine Willman. I live in Western Montana. And this morning I received a call from two of your members, Gary and Ron. I don't recall their last names, but I had a wonderful visit with them.
Right, they're the welcoming committee, yep.
And several months ago, I was invited to do a presentation on federal Indian policy on one of your Thursday evening programs. And I've been interested in National Liberty Alliance ever since. And in discussions with Ron and Gary this morning, I was encouraged to call in this evening and see about scheduling perhaps another Thursday evening presentation. There's a piece that I call the best kept secret, and it's Title 25 in the statute.
Okay.
Title 25 is...
So it's a federal
Indian law. That's Indian policy.
That's interesting because I don't have a 25. You know, I've got them all listed down here, but 25 seems to be not here. And you're saying it deals with the policies with Indians?
Yes. Yes, it's all of federal Indian policy, and all of Title 25 should not exist at all. All of federal Indian policy is way outside of our U.S. Constitution. Our framers and founders never,
maybe
ever contemplated.
Maybe that's why it's not even there. It's not even listed
And it is basically administrative law put together by bureaucratic administrators. But my point is, in our United States, we currently have 573 separate tribal governments who have land holdings within the various states that are exempt from all state jurisdictions. These are tribal lands that are not Republican form and that are eroding and reducing the land base in all of our states. And the political system is such that these tribes are inordinately wealthy. And these tribal governments, unlike any other government, have the ability to directly fund and finance political parties, incumbents, candidates. And I think the poster child I could share with your listeners is Washington State. It's a small state. You could put three of the land base of Washington State in Montana. Washington State has 29 tribes that politically and financially control the state of Washington now. So much so that the current Attorney General of Washington State in early May issued a press release that said, effective immediately, his office will not make any policy decisions or take any formal actions on anything out of the office of the Attorney General without the prior consent and approval of the state's 29 tribal governments. That attorney general just sacrificed the state sovereignty of Washington State to the whims of 29 tribal governments, not Republican form. So there's a whole lot I would like to discuss with your listeners because this is a best-kept secret. These are decisions made by legislators, bureaucrats, even local and county and state officials, none of which really requires anything in the way of public hearings or notice to the public. These tribal governments are incrementally capturing a land base in at least 29 states and capturing the governor's offices, the state legislators. We are being overwhelmed with the spread of tribalism replacing the republic form of government, all of which is completely outside of our Constitution. So I've been studying this for 30 years.
It sounds like you know what's going on there. And get a hold of Jan. Okay, Jan at National Liberty Alliance. Give them a call. You said you've already done one thing on this once before?
Okay. Yes.
Get a hold of Jan. Get a hold of Jan.
Okay.
Get a hold of Jan and let them know that you want to talk some more again on this issue. When Jan gets back, I'll find out when this was, when you had the last one. How long did you speak for? An hour? 45 minutes?
I think I spoke for about 45 minutes, and then it was opened up to question and answers.
I want to just ask some questions, and I'll let you speak some more.
Sure.
Now, you on your first 45 minutes, you gave a good overview of what's going on. I mean, you gave me an overview, and I'm not sure exactly.
Yes.
Still, there's a lot of questions, a lot of mystery here, because I have no knowledge in this area, and I'd like to get schooled in it. Look, Indians have been beat up pretty bad. We can't allow anything to disturb our existing republic, of course, but that doesn't mean we can't work something out. Obviously, there are some agreements that have been made with Indian tribes, and you say there's like 573 tribal governments. Is that what they're called?
Yes.
And they have a certain amount of power and authority, I presume, in certain areas. I don't know how they can possibly control a state. I don't think they can injure a state. You know, there's a lot of problems with the territories. And, you know, we've got the government still has territories. Let's take Puerto Rico, for instance. Puerto Rico is a territory. And Guam, the Philippines, all those places. And but it's U.S. territory. They're under U.S. rule. We have federal district courts in those territories, and yet, you know, the way it used to be, when you have a certain amount of people, a certain population in a certain, you know, geographical area, the people can come together and decide to become a state, and then they can file papers with the federal government and move forward. And there's certain procedures and processes that take place in order to get this done. And it's got to be separate from other states. You know, you can't take a piece of a state and make another state of it. But that doesn't mean we, you know, something can't be figured out on what's going on. For instance, you mentioned there's quite a few tribal governments. I think you said 30-some-odd of them in Washington State. Is that what it is?
Yeah, 29 in Washington State.
29, okay, in Washington State. We need to understand this is something we need to think about, and I'd like to get involved somewhat in this to think about this and make a proposal and bring it to the president, and because the president should want to deal with this also, and I'm sure he would. And
I'm drafting a letter.
Puerto Rico and other territories have been prevented from becoming states by the federal government itself, because it is advantageous for them to maintain and hold on to territories. It's never meant for the United States to have and hold on to territories. As soon as it's possible to create some kind of a government within that and make it a free and independent state, but again, it's got to meet a certain criteria, you know, a certain geographical area, a certain population, and a voting of the people to do this. And I know in a heartbeat, Puerto Rico would love to become a state in just a heartbeat, okay? But they're being prevented from that happening. Philippines also and other places, you know, they're all being prevented from allowing this to go forward because, again, advantageous to
here's a very important piece of what you're discussing. You're speaking of federal territories wherein the federal government utilizing federal territorial war powers is the deciding factor in these territories. But once a state achieves its statehood, the federal government's territorial war powers may not be implemented against the state. And it is these territorial war powers that is allowing the federal government to recognize and create a tribal government, acquire land and call it a federal territory within the state, and it's enacting war powers against that state to do so. That is the fundamental flaw of federal Indian policy. So you now have 29 separate governments that have nothing to do with the state of Washington, 29 separate little individual territories administered under the federal war powers in a state. And it's
well, again,
so
you know,
wrong.
Again, we have to look at this and try to figure out the problem. And look at, you know, natural law has a solution for all this. But first we have to understand the problem, and then we can apply natural law towards it and make it work. People need to be free. Look, we also have a serious problem with all of the territory that the federal government has claimed, you know, especially out west. They've got a claim on a lot of territory and control.
Yeah.
They have the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management controlling it and so on. You know, these big parks and forests and stuff. These things need to be turned back over to the states. This belongs to the state that the territory is in. It's not really a territory. Like, you have a forest that's being protected, or you have a park, which is a forest usually, that's being protected. And there's a lot of money to be made on these parks, and the state should be benefiting from that, not the federal government. They should not be in this business. The BLM should not even exist. Okay, Bureau of Land Management might exist from the standpoint of assisting the state if they want assistance, but that's about it. And the states need to control this. And again, this is another problem that needs to be dealt with. And, you know, I wouldn't put this on the top of the first burner here. I'd put it in the back burner, and it's something I'd like to get educated on. So, look, talk to Jan. Work this out. I'm going to go back and listen to your recording of the last one, and I'll come listen to the next one, and then maybe we'll have a conference together and talk and more questions on a personal level to try to understand this situation better. Because
Please let me close with one thing. I am Cherokee. I am 30% Cherokee Indian, and my spouse is Shoshone, a descendant of Sacagawea. We make very clear, I've lived under Indian reservations for 30 years. Most of our friends are tribal families that I try to help as best I can. But I make clear separations between respect for American Indian history and culture that is very separate from government decision-making. And that's the issue, is the government decision-making is far afield of our Constitution and is decimating our state.
Absolutely. Look, at any time the federal government steps in and starts to make decisions for the people of the state, it's a problem. As long as they can maintain the territory, they don't have too much, really pushing back on them, you know. In the states, I'm not sure on what exactly is going on in that and how. But I need to get educated on it. So let's get a hold of Jan. And I'll talk with them soon also myself to get your audio, and then I'll listen in on your meeting, and then maybe we'll talk some more. But it is something that needs to be done. Let me ask you a question across the board. You know, first of all, you know, the 10th Amendment gives all of the powers and the authorities that were not given to the federal government, anything that's not mentioned in our Constitution belongs to the state. And, of course, they've abused that, and they've gotten away with it because, again, we are ignorant. The people are ignorant. We don't understand these things. We don't know them. And this should be common knowledge. It should be taught in our schools. And so we're teaching it here at National Liberty Alliance, and we will eventually get this into schools. But people need to understand these things and the power and the authority that the people have on the state level. And the federal government needs us to keep their nose out of this. Now, with that kind of thinking in mind, bringing the Constitution, empowering back the Constitution to its proper place, with the opportunity of some of these places to come in for statehood, would generally across the board, are Indians interested in that kind of thing, to have their own statehood and authorities and the powers as any other state, and then work from that point to, underneath the federal government, under its proper chains and controls, that being the Constitution? Do they have an interest in that?
That could be an option, but I think a better option is that all American Indians were declared full citizens in 1924. But 10 years later, in 1934, we got the Indian Reorganization Act put together by a communist named John Collier.
Yeah, we got to fix that. That's a problem. Look, that could be overturned in...
Please let me finish. Your enrolled tribal members who are full American citizens lose all of their civil rights and their Bill of Rights as enrolled members in the tribal government. So they have a dual citizenship that removes their civil rights and Bill of Rights. So a better option would be that the federal government returns the title to the tribal lands back to the tribes, and that those lands go back into the state base for jurisdiction, and that Indian enrolled members become full citizens of their state once again, as they should have been in 1924.
I agree. Listen, this is all could be nullified. But it can't be nullified until people have the knowledge and take the power and the authority and exercise it. And again, that's what we're trying to do here at National Liberty Alliance. When people get to that point, now we can start nullifying these things and bring things back to where it belongs. We can force our legislators to start to remove these unconstitutional acts and different statutes that they have written. We can force them to recognize the fact that, look, at these Indians should be full citizens and have complete, you know, you could be a foreigner on American soil. You have all the Bill of Rights. Rights are unalienable. They're given by God, not given by a government. So if you happen to be a person just traveling through the United States from some foreign country, and you exercise your unalienable rights, they have to be there's an obligation on the government to acknowledge that and to enforce the protections of those rights on that person, because, again, rights are unalienable. This is a point we need to be made, and the Indians need to understand, the government needs to understand. And more than that, you know, I don't know about civil rights. I don't need civil rights. I got unalienable rights. So civil rights is something that the state gives you. Yeah. State gives me nothing, it owes me nothing, and I owe it nothing. I do not have to answer to the state or anything. I answer to God in a court of law through 12 individuals who make a decision on me should someone bring charges up against me. That's the only place I answer to anyone. And people need to understand this and start exercising that and nullifying the things that are incorrect. Let's take the 17th Amendment, which is destructive and took away the sovereignty of our states, eclipsed sovereignty, but they were sovereign. The states are no longer sovereign. They have no power, no authority, no say of anything that the federal government does. Why? Because of the 17th Amendment removed the senators from them and applied it to the people. The people already had representation. Okay, the state. There was a balance of power that our founding fathers negotiated and put together, and you go back to the Federalist Papers, and they discuss all these issues. It is totally destructive of our process of government, totally destructive of our sovereignty, okay, and the state sovereignty. We need to just, and we've already sent papers to the governors of every state here back, I think, in 2017, which will be part of our case, and we've informed the governors of their powers and authorities to nullify the 17th Amendment. Just deny it. Call back your senators. Put your own senators in there. They'll go do the will of the legislators and the governor of the state that they come from. And if the legislator is not happy with them representing them properly, taking some of that funny money, they can call them right back and send two other people there. That's the power of the state, the authority of the state, and they need to exercise it. And if they were exercising it without the 17th Amendment, they could never have pulled off what they've pulled off with us. And if Clinton was elected president, as many people have said, we'd be probably at war at this point. We'd probably be under martial law. They'd be rounding us up. We'd be in big, big trouble. All that which we've been fearing over the years and worried about when they're going to do it would have happened, because we've reached the end point for them. But it didn't happen that way. Now we have an opportunity, and we could take it all back. Yeah. But people have to get educated and step up. But finish up, you know, take another minute, and then I got to move on. Go ahead.
Tribal members do not even have parental rights over their children. Congress in 1978 gave tribal governments the full parental rights over all enrollable American citizens 18 and under.
That's null and void.
Well,
it's repugnant.
It's null and void, but it has destroyed tribal families because tribal governments
They get away with this because of ignorance. Okay, why they get away with it, because of ignorance. The people need to take the power and wash away their ignorance by education, okay?
That's why I'm interested in your organization.
God gave power and authority of your children to the individual who birthed those children. Mom and dad, that's their property, and rightly so. Until they're old enough to take care of themselves and make their own decisions, that is up to the parent. Don't stick your finger into that electrical socket. Give them a little whack because they're going to get hurt, you know. So that's the power and the authority of the parent. The state has no business in that. And even though people are Indian, they have no business of anybody's children. Okay, none.
No.
We need to fix it.
No.
People, we need to fix it. Let me move on, and I'll be looking forward to hearing your recording and listening some more and having a conversation, private conversation maybe with some leadership on this issue. Then we'll have this private conversation in public. Maybe we'll just do it in a room and invite people if they want to come in and listen, so that we can get a question and answer to understand more and information, documents, anything we can get to come to a comprehension of what this is, how this works, and the evil that's being done and how we can undo it.
Very good.
Okay?
Thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you. Appreciate the call, Elaine.
Uh-huh.
Elaine's the name. That was your name, Elaine?
Yes, Elaine.
All right.
Wilman.
Okay, thank you. We're going to take our next caller now. Okay, let's go to Cynthia up in Massachusetts. I think you're in Massachusetts, aren't you?
No, I'm in an undisclosed location, but I'm from Massachusetts. And
Spoke
to you last week, John.
I know you. I know your voice. I recognize you.
Yes, and my phone is funny, and it may shut off. Hopefully it won't. But I've been sending different things to Jan, so hopefully he's forwarding it to you. I've been working with the Colorado Jan. She was on the call before. We're kind of trying to expose all the frauds with Child Protective Services and family court, things like that. And at some point, I'm hoping that we can kind of roll into, you know, what NLA is doing. Now, what you just read in the beginning, did you write that, or was that an excerpt from a book?
No, I wrote that. A lot of that's in the book. I didn't put everything in at that subject there. There's a lot more information on Jefferson and his trying to free the slaves. At every step of the way, Jefferson never ceased from his first appointment to office, and his first thing he did in Virginia when he was sent. He was sent as a legislator in Virginia back, I think it was in 1774 or 5. He was sent twice, two different years as a legislator. And in both cases, when he went, the first order of business was trying to settle up so that slaves could be emancipated.
Yes.
Jefferson never bought a slave in his life.
Wow.
There's no knowledge of any slaves running away from him. As a matter of fact, if you read his history, his slaves loved him. And he was like a father to them. And he inherited the slaves, and it was a dilemma that he was trying to deal with all of his life and trying to get legislation to free the slaves. And at least he started off with trying to get the ability for people to emancipate them.
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson refused to sell his slaves because he didn't know the hands of the people they'd go into. And so he couldn't sell, because he didn't want to sell his slaves, he couldn't emancipate them. It was against the law in Virginia.
Right.
So he couldn't emancipate them. He was stuck between a rock and a hard place.
I was just about to say that.
Trying to prevent the spread of slavery in the western states and so on. But all the slaves he got, he inherited from his father and from his father-in-law.
Yeah. Now what you recited, are you going to post it on the NLA website?
Yeah, it's up there right now on the front page if you want to read the paper, okay?
Because it's really inspiring. It really is. And I think it's hopeful, and I think it's very unifying. And that's the spirit, you know. That's the spirit I'm trying to convey. I'm trying to stay in the center where Jesus is and not go left, you know, go crazy with all the craziness that's going on and the divisions in this country. It's really, mm-hmm. really upsetting to see what's going on out there.
Our nation shouldn't have divisions. If we would have followed the prescription, and Washington was trying to put them back on track, and they just didn't hear, and I'm sure there was a lot of reasons that they couldn't do it. Today we can do it, though, if we can get the people educated. But the key thing, though, yeah. is that, you know, there is no reason for the politics. Not that the political process is one thing. Everyone should understand that. But we shouldn't have to deal with the politics, the BS, all of the, you know,
right.
trying to empower this group over that group, getting the voting
right.
this way to benefit this group and this group
right.
trying to get their benefits. You know, that's all the politics. If we followed the law and the structure of the Constitution, there's no room for politics. When these people go to Washington and they get this funny money from all of these different, you know, groups, they
right.
take this money, and then they do the will of those people. Well, wait a second. What
right.
happened to the people in the state that sent
right.
you there? Aren't
right.
you there to do their will, to take care of their
right.
needs in
right.
your area? These people have sold themselves. They're
right.
prostituting themselves and
right.
getting all this money, enriching themselves, empowering themselves,
right.
And just ignoring the American people. Well, we can
at
stop.
Our expense, right? At our expense,
absolutely. We can stop all this by getting knowledge, empowering ourselves, taking control of the courts, taking control of the political process, and make it illegal. Which it look it in logic, it's illegal. You don't even have to make a law; just bring this case before the people and get some people, you know, get an indictment, get them before 12
yeah.
jurors. And tell them of the evil that they're doing there with all this money, and they will do something about it. We don't need laws to fix the problem. We need the people to be dragged into courts. You know,
yeah.
it's called bribery, and you don't need a law to know what bribery is. If you're being bribed, okay, that's against the law, and that's
right.
punishable in a court of law, and it needs to be. So these people
yeah,
need
but,
to stop taking this funny money.
Right, but... You know, you mentioned, you said President Trump, you know, took control of the Federal Reserve. I mean, I'm not sure about that because, you know, we're running
oh, yeah.
around. They got us converted as all debtors, number one, and, you know, we're claiming that we're responsible for that crazy debt out there. And it's not really, you know, we're the creditors, actually, you know. So they got it flip-flopped. Mm-hmm. And what was it, like in 1933?
There's a lot going on that you don't know about. There's things going on, of course,
right.
that I don't know about. But I do have certain knowledge of certain things.
Right.
And I have suspicions on how he's going to move. He can't expose his plan. Okay, he can't. He's got to exercise it little by little. I have a lot of trust in this guy. He's really already proved himself. I knew he was going to be the right guy. As soon as I heard he was running for president, I didn't even have to hear his speeches. I've heard about him going years, 20, 30, 40 years ago on local TV stations out there in New York, because that's where I come from. But in any event, he's got a plan. And it's unknown to most people, but it had been reported by Q and other sources. He's already seized gold that has already been stolen from We the People. And it's already been brought back to the United States. There is a plan to exercise it. And he's going to work out. Look, we may be in debt and have a lot of debt, but it's really not our debt to begin with. It belongs to the
right.
Federal Reserve as a private bank. It's their debt, not ours. So we need
right.
to go after those families. And I know he's going to do this. And I look at other countries have been injured by this, too. And so
right.
I'm sure that's also part of his plan to work out. Look, we're going to go get these people when the time comes. We're going to get our money back. We're going to take away all this property that they've stolen anyway, all this money to buy this property. We're going to take it back, and we're going to divide it among the nations. I mean,
right.
I got to believe that's part of his plan, plus the seizing of gold that has been stolen by, you know, from the American people. And I think they caught some of it up in the Philippines.
Right,
and they were
right,
moving
right.
it from there
right.
in shipment. They were able to capture that gold back. And I've heard of other gold seizures that was American gold. He's got a plan on a soft landing so that we're not going to have a total collapse. I mean, we could have, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think he's got a plan to be able to bring this back.
Well, yes. Well, my understanding is that 1933, FDR pledged all of us, all of our children, our property, our names, our land, pledged it to...
But remember, that's a fraud, but go ahead.
Yeah, it pledged everything, you know.
Right, it's a fraud.
Right, it is a fraud.
In order for them to have exercised and executed all that at some point in time, which would have been about now, Clinton would have had to have been president. And then it could have been executed, and all this collapsing could be taking place and destruction, keeping the people busy as they're collecting and getting rid of all their enemies and so on and so forth. But look, this man definitely has a plan.
Yeah.
And remember, he's the master of bankruptcies, okay? Anybody that knows his background, he's the master. He was a billionaire, lost it all, got it all back again. He's the master of this stuff. And I wouldn't say that he totally lost everything, but he was in jeopardy of losing everything. And he protected himself very well, and he was able to spring back very quickly. But look at, you know, he's taken lessons, I'm sure, from Kennedy, too, because Kennedy had a plan, and all he did was put out silver certificates, and he knew that eventually that would fix the problem. And he's talking something.
Yeah, unfortunately got killed. I mean, everybody who tried to do something for us. Huh?
Yeah. That's why.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, so we're going to, you know, keep praying for his safety and everything. But this is what I asked you this before, and you said you'd think about it or something. I'd like to run, you know, I'd like to help NLA and maybe even Market, because I've been in touch with a lot of, you know, families who are suffering, a lot of people losing their homes, even organizations. And Jan in Colorado is doing a lot of work, you know, for families and things, too.
I am too. We'll do amicus curiae for them and move the process into federal court for cause and execute some judgment for them.
Yes, but, you know, I guess, yes, that's a part of it. But also, you know, we want to, you know, kind of really get involved with NLA. But one thing I'd like to ask you, because you are such a wonderful writer, and I think if you could kindly just put out a brief memorandum to define who we the people are and who is entitled to, you know, all of the Bill of Rights and all of that here in this nation. And that would be very unifying, because there's obviously all kind of divisions and a lot of people have different opinions. And I look at the whole Constitution and everything from a godly perspective, but I'm not sure if everybody else, you know, out there is. You see what I'm saying? Like, when I look at the Creator, I see God Almighty, you know, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, that's from the Bible. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But I'm just wondering, like, from NLA's perspective and their way of looking at the Constitution and all of that, who is we the people, in essence?
Mm-hmm. Well, look, it, you know, we're king. There's a biblical principle. Jesus Christ is King of Kings. All of his children are kings. And that's why the Constitution, Jefferson understood this, our founding fathers understood this. We the people need to understand this, because unfortunately we don't, okay? That is why the preamble to the Constitution is, we the people ordained and established this Constitution for the United States of America. Okay, that's an important point. Who ordained? Kings ordain. Okay, and this is some of the things we were looking at and reading today. Of course, you know, concerning the fact that we're not to be under legislation, we are to be under the law itself. It was Samuel Adams who said, "The natural liberty of man is to be free from any superior power on earth." That's legislators, judges, anybody. We're free from all of that. And it goes on, and not to be under the will of the legislative authority of man, but only to have the law of nature for his rule. That's why they cannot, that's why when we challenge jurisdiction, they don't have it, because they're equity courts. There are only two types of courts, equity courts and natural law courts. Law is natural law. Everybody understands that. If you go into Black's Law's Dictionary, Bouvier's, everywhere you go, law is natural law, okay? Statutes,
John,
and yes. Other things are codes and regulations.
Right.
That's for the bureaucrat, written by the people.
Yes. John, you're so inspiring. God bless you. I think you and I are on the same page, but not everybody has the same opinion. So I'm just asking if you can, you know,
right.
You know, to convey NLA's position with respect to who we the people are and who's entitled to the Bill of Rights from NLA's perspective and the Constitution, and we can run with it and try to unify people.
Right. Well, look, this
and
is
get
what
people
needs to be
involved,
done.
Huh?
This is what needs to be done. You know, you could tell people, and people want to debate and argue because they have a certain knowledge that they think is truth. And, you know, our greatest injuries is not from things we don't know. It's from things we
right.
think we know and don't. That's where our greatest injuries come from. And it's
right.
hard to tell people that they're wrong, that they're error, that they don't understand things. But it works best
right.
if you can show them. Now, here's the key. It's only going to take about 25 or 30,000 people across this entire nation to take control of this government. And once those 25 to 30,000 people, we're looking at about, let's say 3,000, 26, 92, about 15 to 20,000 people to take control of the court systems, okay? That's four administrators for in every county and extra in large counties. And then you got the committee men, which we need, you know, we'd like to get at least four in every county, five in every county, but even if we only get five or six in every state, we can take back
right.
the power and the authority on the political side of things. And that's what we're trying to teach the people, for people to step
right.
up, and then we'll fill all the vacancies to get a lot more than that, but we, meanwhile,
right.
we can control it. Now, if we can control those two powers, the
right.
the political power and the judicial power, that's all the power we need, okay?
Right.
The most important power is spiritual power, so the people who are controlling the political power and the judicial power, they need to realize that the king of the court
right.
is God. And it doesn't matter how people understand God. They can understand God in any way they want. You know, even the Jews in the days when they had their liberty for 400 years that we read a little bit about today, that Jefferson had discovered on the principles that gave them liberty, the eight principles that he got into the Declaration of Independence. The Jews, there was always people with them that were not of their faith, and they were happy to live with the Jews, and the Jews let them come in. Our nation
right.
was created the very same way. You can be an atheist. That's fine. You can enjoy what we have, but we are
right.
a people of law. So all we have to do is exercise and execute the law. And it takes the control of those two power structures to control that. And when you control those two power structures and you exercise the law, all of a sudden all this other stuff starts to disappear because
right.
politics doesn't play a role no more. Politics becomes ultimately illegal because it's fraud to go and sell your soul and your vote to some special interest groups.
Yeah.
That's a crime, okay? All
right.
that stuff stops. And if the politicking
yeah.
disappears and we get courts of justice, okay, when people living under those conditions are going to see the fruit over a very short period of time and the benefits of that, and through that they will get the knowledge of what we're doing and the happiness that goes along with
yes.
it.
Yes.
So,
now, there's another issue. If you could, no, seriously, if you could, I hear you, I'm with you,
I've written much on what you're thinking. I'll see if I can pull it together in one paper.
Yeah, just something brief, because we can run with it, and it'll be very unifying. Now, I'll say
yeah.
this. I could, you know, actually, I was put in slavery, I feel, you know, but I'm just saying, but that doesn't ever take away my unalienable rights. I'm just asking from NLA's perspective, because that would create unity and draw people into NLA, because you need more membership and you need, you know, more collaboration from some of these organizations or members in some of these organizations. And I think if you can just spell out NLA's position based on everything that you're saying, you know, because it's
right, well,
true,
I,
and
like
it's godly.
Said,
it's very godly.
I've already done papers on this. Like I said, I will try to collect and do one special paper that kind of pulls it all together.
Yes.
After I get the court case completed, I'll put some time into this, and shouldn't take me much to pull it together.
And people out there will not be able to say otherwise, because that's a godly position. So thank you for that. Also, I just want to bring up another issue, and it occurred to me, I mean, this has been my problem, but I was reading about a case on Natural News, and this poor mother, I don't even know which state it was, but she had an autistic son. And I don't know, out of nowhere, DCF or CPS went in, took her son, okay?
Yeah, there he is.
And for 2 months, she doesn't even know where her son is for 2 months.
Right.
And so then, I don't know, all this investigating, she finds out that the foster family is going to take the son to Disney World or something. But one of the allegations, which is scary, the whole thing is terrifying me, especially
so
not having...
It's so evil.
Well, it's like grooming to me. That's how I see it. But the issue that was raised is that DCF is accusing her of... drugs, and she is standing, and she goes, I don't do drugs, I never do drugs, I've never, so that brings to mind, and this is a problem, not with drugs per se, but other false allegations that was in the records out there concerning me, which contributed to my, you know, as you, when you talk about Jefferson being slandered, you know, that kind of thing, but you know, all of these records out there are all collaborating with each other, and it just takes a, you know, somebody going in, putting in false information, and then the machine starts working, and then next you know, you lose your children.
All we need, the answer and the solution to all of this is the law. We just need just courts, okay? If we don't have a just court, then we're not going to solve these problems. And, of course, that's the just courts will solve all these problems, okay? And anybody that comes that really takes a good look on what National Liberty Alliance is doing, they will come to a realization and understanding that our true purpose is to empower the people on a grassroots level. And we empower them through educations and showing them where the power structures are and how to take control of that power structure so that the people can take control of things and put the king back into the court. Become under courts of justice again. And these evil SOBs that come and take these, our people, our children, okay? They're the most low-life and evil people, in my opinion, of them. And it would stop in just courts. Family court is nothing but just a fraud. It's evil.
Right.
It doesn't work. It never worked, and it can never work. It needs to, the whole new system needs to be set up, and we have a plan for that, too. We don't want to get into too much detail on that, but we do have a plan for that, and it's very simple. It gets right back to the courts of justice, okay? Yeah. And the people need to take control of these things. We got to get rid of all these lawyers, these judges, and all of these bar attorneys, and all these legal mungo-jungle BS, and get back to people and their problems and their situations and deal with them. And help people. And that's what needs to be done. Educate people. But anyway,
I love to do that. And I love what you're doing. And I love the spirit you're coming in on. It's very godly. And I do hope that you do that, remember, because I think it really helped people out there. We can run with it and market it and so on and so forth. So I just want to put that out and stress it. I'll probably remind you if you don't mind.
No. And once the papers are filed and a week or two goes by, bring it back into memory and let's start talking about it some more.
Okay. Well, thank you so much again. God bless.
Thank you. You too, Cynthia. Godspeed. Okay, our next caller, 812 area code, no name. I got to need a name, first name, and a state. 812.
Can you hear me, John?
We can hear you. First name and state.
I'm Joel. I'm from Indiana. I actually have a law question. My daughter just got into a little bit of trouble. She's a minor. She's 16. And the last day of school, I believe it was June 6th, there's a bully on the bus, and she's been bullying her for about a year and a half now. And apparently my daughter had enough and smacked this girl. So her mother called the police, and they filed a report. Now, there's nothing, this girl has no damage to her. I mean, she had a red mark, and that was it. But the police came here. Now, I knew better than to talk to the police, but, you know, dummy me, I just assumed that something so minor wouldn't matter. Well, that wasn't the case. He put the police report in, and they have charged her with assault and battery. Now, we haven't been, or she hasn't been arraigned yet or anything. They first called us up and told us that, or it was a probation officer that called us up and told us to come in and talk to her. But she said that my daughter would have to give up her rights. And I, you know, as soon as I heard that, I was like, well, I don't know if we're going to do that or not. And so she said that she would talk to the prosecutor, and she wound up calling me back and told me that we didn't have to come talk to her, that we would just have to go before the judge. So, you know, I don't know if you can help me out or not.
This matter really belongs between the parents and the school as the arbitrator in this thing to fix the problem and make sure it doesn't happen again. And I'm sure there's problems on both sides that caused this to escalate to that point.
Sure.
But, yeah, look, these people coming in with their quote-unquote law, which is no law at all to begin with, okay, they come in, they're not interested in really solving the problem. They're interested in exercising power and authority, and they end up just injuring people more, make things worse, create more problems, and ultimately just destroy. If you feel that it's a dangerous situation and it's not going to turn out well, and they're going to press this issue in a legal matter that's going to do more injury to people, your daughter particularly, then you can do a joinder with us, and we'll do an amicus curiae and run through the process of defending the case.
I mean, that sounds good. Now, I'm pretty new at this.
What we do is
this.
This is what we do. Listen, I don't know that there's been a court of law in this country in at least 50 years and probably longer. I just don't know if one exists. I haven't seen one anywhere, okay? We're under courts of law. We're not under – law is interested in restitution. And not only restoring the injured party, but in the process restoring the person who produced the injury. It's not about punishment. It's not about jail. It's about restoring order and restoring ultimately the heart and the soul. That's what law is really all about. And
right.
You go down into it, you're going to find, there are prescriptions for a lot of things. And repentance is part of that prescription. Throwing someone in jail and punishing them and injuring them more creates more heartache, more anger, more pain, more distortment, and it doesn't go anywhere but just breed more problems in the future. That's all it does. Where law is interested in the restitution and restoring and bringing the people that had odds back together again, ultimately through that process of restitution and restoring the person back to their original state. And this is pretty minor. This seems to be blown out of proportion. The cops never should have been called into this thing. The school should have dealt with this between parents. But even that, we've got social schools that are teaching, socialism. They're not teaching justice. They're teaching social justice. Social justice is the epitome of socialism. We've got a governor here in New York State. He's calling for social justice. I'm calling for justice. Social justice is socialism. It's where everybody gets an equal piece, and people don't, it's a pure dividing of property, which never really happens anyway, because ultimately the people on the top take it all, and the mass gets nothing anyway. They're just fooled into thinking they're going to get something, and at the end they get nothing. And that's the real the shame of the whole thing. But, in any event, you know, if you're concerned about it really growing out of getting worse and not getting repaired and deal with this problem, then we could do an amicus curiae. What we do is we challenge the jurisdiction. They don't have it. And then we get them for denying your due process because they're not giving it. I don't care if they call a jury in and they give you and even if the jury, a grand jury, gives an indictment and they send you into a court and they get a trial jury together and they give you a trial, that's all irrelevant because these are all statutory controlled juries. They're not juries of the people. They're not juries of the heart. They're not coming from the law. They're coming from equity, which is really legislative law, the laws of men. And not of God. And so the whole process is unlawful, illegal, and they have no power and authority. And that's where we're pressing these cases to that point.
All right, so how can I go ahead and get a joinder in an amicus curiae then? Do I need to contact Jan?
Just go to intake@nationallibertyalliance.org. You'll eventually talk with a guy named James, and he'll walk you through the process and explain everything to you. And if you want to go through, we'll help you.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's great then. I'm actually a member of National Liberty Alliance. Would I find James in the members section?
No, just intake@nationallibertyalliance.org. Write an email to intake@nationallibertyalliance.org. That goes to James, and he's dealing with the paperwork.
Okay, intake@nationalliberty.org.
National Liberty Alliance.
That's really my question right there.
NationalLibertyAlliance.org.
Okay. National Liberty Alliance.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, John.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's take our next call. You're welcome. Thank you. We've got California Fred. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Hello, John. This is California Fred.
That's what I thought I said.
Oh,
how
I
you
was
doing?
I was hitting the button so I could speak, and that muted you.
Okay.
Well, I'm sorry. I heard something of interest to National Liberty Alliance, and I don't know if I heard it right or not, but President Trump made some noise about the new requirements for citizenship, and he mentioned the fact that they would learn civics. Let that sink in and research it.
He said the facts what?
He said the new citizen requirements that he's reviewing right now, they're gonna teach civics to the people.
There's already a law, there's a federal law requiring any school, any place that gets money from the government must teach civics. And
well,
yet they don't, it's not applied. And we are exercising that.
When did that law come about?
Oh, goodness, it's been around for quite some time, maybe 30, 40, maybe more years.
Because that's one of the things that I believe it's Thomas Jefferson said is to teach them civics. It's right there.
Absolutely, absolutely. The people need to be educated. You cannot have liberty if the people are not educated in liberty. You know, and people think they know what liberty is and freedom is. They really don't know. They think they know. Liberty is freedom from all legislative authorities. That's what liberty is. It's freedom from government. That's what liberty is. Okay? We have unalienable rights from the government that protects us from the government. We're also protected from injury from other people because that's what a court of law is all about.
Well, anyway, I wanted to make that comment that Trump said they were going to teach civics to the people that are applying for citizenship as part of a course.
Right. Well, they need to be teaching civics to any child born and going to school. Okay? It needs to be taught in school. We're going to exercise that. Again, it's up to the people to step up and let's get this done. We need to capture this before others do because I will tell you, I have never been involved in a civics course, a constitutional course, with the exception of Michael Bodnarik. It was a very good course that he had put out. But I have not been a part of any of the civic courses, constitutional courses, that haven't bored me to tears. It's boring, okay? And the reason why it's boring is because they give you pablum. You know, they never teach you the Constitution. They talk about the Constitution, but they don't give you the Constitution. Because the Constitution is what it is. You don't need more than that. Get a good dictionary, take your time, go through the Constitution, and you can understand it. And it's very beneficial, it's very powering, and everything. And so we put together a great course, consent of government course, which is a very, very powerful course. And anybody that goes through that will understand the courts, they'll understand the Constitution, liberty, law, they'll understand the whole gambit of things, even government and structure, and how the political process ought to work. All of this.
One
and
question.
We need to get in ahead of the game to be able to be the people that put the courses into the schools.
One
because
question.
We don't want to go back to teaching children what to think. We want to teach children how to think.
Exactly my point. Now, here's the question. I'm sick of reading rules for civil procedure. Where do we find the common law rules of procedure? Where
it's
is it
the
spelled
rules
out?
Of the heart. Yes, son. It's the rules of the heart. Look at.
I understand what you're trying to say, the rules of God.
Listen,
written and unwritten.
I'm going to tell you, it's all logic and obvious. And they can write down a certain rules, but they can't be held to the letter. It just could be a formula of an idea of what to work off of.
It's got to be a process in court. And it's got to be the process is what you're complaining about in due process of law, John. What I'm trying to tell you is the process in common law needs to be spelled out so you can follow it. What and when to file what?
There's a great book written by an individual who teaches here, okay, Brent Winters, The Excellence of the Common Law.
Yeah.
Now, it's a little bit of a kind of a, when I first read it, for me, it was still a little difficult, and it was my second time around when I had gotten more of an education and was reading it that it became powerful for me. But in any event, you read the way that it used to work. Look it, nobody knows better of right and wrong than the people themselves. And the people are your peers, you know, the people of your community, where you live, where you work, where you do your business with, where your activities and exchanges of all kinds of things takes place. It's the people, okay? And it's a very simple thing. It's pretty much logic, and it's obvious. And we can take the general rules that they've already got and apply some of them. You don't need much, okay? One of the major rules is that, when you file a court case, you have to be able to prove that you served that person. And there's lots of ways to do that. You know, there's more than one way to skin a cat. But there's a lot of ways you could do it. So you can do any one of those things that work. And this way, if they don't show up, then they default, and the case can be taken care of, and you can run through a summary judgment that is lawful because of a default, okay? But there's always an opportunity at the end, to repair to some degree. But everything is logic. When you go into a court, there's only one thing that needs to be discussed there, and that's the facts of whatever's going on. That's all. It's all it takes. We don't need nobody to come in with these crazy ideas of some kind of a loophole law that, oh, they don't have to do that, or we can get out of this for doing this, and you can't hold that because of that. You know, that's all, what would you call it? That's the way that lawyers work. Everything is trickery and leverage and trying to escape the conclusion of what is right, okay? When you go to court, you just bring up the facts. What happened? Okay, and you go through it, and you got 12 people examining the words of what people are speaking. There's nothing more to add to it. Okay, those 12 people get together, and the next thing you know, one person says, "Well, I think this, that, and the other thing because of this happened." And another person says, "Yeah, but you've heard the other person what happened here, and that this, that, and the other thing." You know, it's a discussion, and before you know it, those 12 people come up with a conclusion. Now, if they can't come up with a conclusion, then you got to set the person free. You can't find someone guilty if just one jurist decides that the person is not guilty of the situation. They got to walk, and they need to understand that, okay? And but when you got 12 people looking from 12 different points of view, 12 different minds examining the stories and looking for the consistencies and the inconsistencies. And any cop will tell you that's how they know who's guilty. They look for the consistencies and the inconsistencies, you know, the contradictions. And even the fact that if your story is perfect all the time saying the same thing, that in itself could be a problem. And cops know that. They understand that. People know that innately. They know it inwardly. They understand that. So law is really about really getting to the truth of the matter. What are the facts? Give me the facts, and you can win or lose a case, you know, by the facts.
I helped my brother with some court cases, and
there is a process of law and how papers
John,
work.
Let me finish, please. I know there's a process. What I did is I uncovered the fact that the attorney herself was lying. I got her in what you call perjury.
Well, that's not a surprise, is it?
Well, here's the surprise. The court didn't want to do anything to this hag. They didn't want to censure her.
No.
Yeah, I had to write a letter to the grand jury and ask them to investigate. I wrote a letter to the Bar Association, yank this lady's permission to practice law. She's lying on the stand to the judge.
Well, they're all lying.
Well,
that's what they're talking about.
I caught her in the lie. I had paperwork back in both ways, and she started squirming, and she was upset for a while, but nothing came of it. I mean, at some mm-hmm. point in time, you got to lock and load. Take your chances.
Right, I understand. But you know, look at the lawyers. They don't even belong, generally speaking. They're counselors. The Constitution says you have a right of counsel. Okay, doesn't say you have a right of a lawyer, especially a bar attorney. Okay, but you know, it's good to have someone who understands how things work. He'd give you some advice and thoughts. But the bottom line is, if you're going to stay quiet and not talk in the courts, with lawyers will tell you that you don't say nothing. But you know, if you're not going to talk, and then you're going to what the witnesses will do all the talking, and you'll find out what took place. And those people who did, you know, their sworn affidavits, and then come up and bear witness to that affidavit, that's how things are going to be decided.
That's another problem. Anytime a witness is testifying, you got these lawyers that get the witnesses to testify about minutia, little things. They can't tell you the whole damn truth. They're burying the truth. They just want them to...
They fill the courts with legalese. That's the problem. They don't belong in courts of law. Look, you can't have a lawyer come up and speak on behalf of another person. That's hearsay. Okay? Yet that's what holds the court. Lawyers come in and they put the case forward for the person that they're representing, and what they say is as if it's gospel. No, that's hearsay. It's secondhand information.
Exactly what the district attorneys do. They act like they were there and they don't know their ass from a... Well, never mind. I shouldn't
right,
swear.
I agree with you. That's the problem. It's legalese. We've got to get rid of them.
Well, look at this Wiseman guy, what he's doing. He's fabricating evidence and he's burying the truth.
Listen, there is a process and a procedure to go through courts that we should all know and generally follow, and you could tweak it here and change it there. There are forms you can use. You can create your own forms, but you got to stay on a plan or a track and make things move forward. But the bottom line is you could take a roll of toilet paper and a lead pencil and write on that toilet paper, this is the facts, this is what took place, so on and so forth, sign it, have it notarized, pass it into the court. You've opened up a court case. You need nothing more than that. That's where it starts, okay? And if it's a situation of an injury, it's not up to the person to have to worry about serving the other side. They file it into the courts. It's up to the court to make that process go through. Now, if someone's suing somebody, that's a whole different story. And maybe you might want to handle that in an equity court because equity courts could move a lot quicker, okay? But you need judges that are honest and really are going to make a good decision on what's really taking place. Unfortunately, there's not many judges that do that.
John, I don't believe it, not for a minute. I mean, we have a Seventh Amendment trial by jury over $20 or more, and yet
right.
we have vaccine courts and tax court. And we got family court and every other travesty known to man. I don't want to waste your time talking about this stuff. I'm just trying to tell you that we've got a whole uphill battle ahead of us with these damn courts, these judges and lawyers. They've been setting this crud up for about the last 60 years.
All right. Well, look, I'm writing a book. We've got a course. I'm writing a book. I assure you that the book will really pretty much have everything. If I miss something, we'll get it in on the next time around. But, you know, I think we're going to cover everything in this book. That book in itself, just learning what's in that book, gives you all the information and necessary things you need to be able to go to court, file your papers, do what you got to do, defend yourself, and you don't even need a lawyer. And everything is free because that's the way it is. Justice should not cost anything for anybody. Now, as far as in the schools, I'm going to take that book and turn it into a textbook and try to get it into schools. Okay, but it's up to the people to work with National Liberty Alliance to get this done. It has to be done. We need people, lots of people behind, giving us that power, that push to be able to do what we got to do.
May I make one suggestion about your book, John?
Yeah.
Okay. Every word in your book, you have to be able to define it with a legal dictionary.
Oh, no doubt.
This is so important. What you really need to do is reference the legal dictionary you're using for reference, whether it's Constitution
Absolutely.
Or what. And
Absolutely.
I'm telling you, with the Black's Law Dictionary, if you look up court of record and you go through your different levels of it, you're going to find different definitions, the devil's at work, changing definitions all the way. And now we've got the politically correct side of the
Well, after the fourth edition, you're right. I mean, they have changed, turned everything upside down. So I use the fourth edition. I also have the second edition. I also have the Beauvilliers law that I also use occasionally. But if you read anything
Fine. Now check this out, John.
I just want to make this point. Hold on a second.
I want to make a point before you make yours. The reason that we have more than the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, the seventh, on up to whatever, how many we got, is because your terms and conditions have to have definitions for a court. Now, what is a computer? You're not going to find that in your fourth edition. You're not going to find internet in your fourth edition, or space, or cosmonaut, or astronaut.
That's okay. That's just the regular term.
The courts have to have legal definition for words that are commonly used in today's language. And by God, that's why they keep publishing another law book. Is
well,
to cover
the
new terms that are used in courts.
In my opinion, the reason they do that is they're trying to change the law. But in any event, that's debatable on both sides, and they both have some umph behind it. But look,
well,
here's the bottom line. Here's
the
bottom line.
In the preference.
Let me finish. I let you talk. Now let me make my point, because this is an important point to me, okay? Because of what you just said about having all of this information, some legal, backing on everything you got. There is absolutely nothing I write that I don't have huge amounts of footnotes. As a matter of fact, I have more footnotes than I do literal writing in anything that I do. And the book that I've got, I remember I was very influenced and impressed by Brent's book, because when you open up his book and you start reading, half the page is full of footnotes, okay? And that's a book that has the power and the authority behind it. And that's how I write. I've learned to write the same way. And so I have huge numbers of footnotes, and it goes back, to founding fathers' statements and principles. It goes back to law, court decisions on specifically the meaning of words, which is what you're talking about. That's mostly what I use the reference to the United States Supreme Court, and which really is a collection, really, that's American jurisprudence, okay? And it gives you the meaning of these things. A court of record is a court of record. It never changes. And I have never seen it in any dictionary where they have injured the meaning of a court of record. It means what it is. A court of record is a natural law court, period. The tribunal is the people. Now, people get confused because there are, and I think I've counted them up. I did a paper on this, and I got to go looking for that paper. I even forget where it's at, but I know I got it. I probably have it up online, too. And I think it's 49 different courts that you can discover. I went through Black's Law, and I found that there's 49 different courts. There's the Court of Exchequer. There is all kinds of equity courts, of course, but there is only one court of law, only one, okay? And that's natural law that's referred to as a court of record. that is ruled by the people, a tribunal of 12 jurists. And that has not changed anywhere that I've seen in any place. So I use that and that references to give meanings. And also there is forms and processes that work. So why don't we use what they've got? As long as it works and it's lawful and it's not deceiving, let's use what they got. They got a lot of stuff that works.
Magic word you just used is lawful. These are legal documents, not lawful. Lawful is common law.
Right. Well, I'm talking about documents that can be exercised in courts of law. You know, it doesn't help if you don't understand how to, express something in a proper way. And a form will make sure you hit all the points to express. So forms can be useful. But if you're ignorant to the forms and you write a paper and you don't express yourself and all the points you need to make it, you know, your point clearly, you may lose the case because of that. And that's because of ignorance. And that's the people's choice to be ignorant. And so they could lose a case for that.
The forms exist for one reason. That's to drag your ass back into jurisdictions unknown in some kind of a law land of equity.
Listen, I understand what you're saying. You're right. But there are lots of forms that work well. And I've created my own forms, which I've worked a lot of off of different points. Look, how to write a paper on a notice and demand. There are 8 points to be made. If you miss one of those points, you're missing a leg, and your case can fall over. And they can wedge in and make the point that this wasn't clear or you didn't make that point, and therefore, you know, you can lose your case on it, all right? So, but you're right. Forms are used to corral the people. They have done an evil thing with it. They've taken a good thing like they do everything else. There's lots of things that are good, and they make it evil because that's what evil does. So, but in any event, we do have something put together for the people that they can use and they can learn. And again, you know, we're putting together the book and we'll put together a textbook and we've got a course and we're trying to train and teach the people, and whatever we miss, we'll catch it next time around. I'm sure we'll miss something, but hopefully minimum to nothing.
Anyway, John, I wanted to tell you this. I didn't think I'd be long for this world, but it turns out I'm going to be kicking for a little longer, so.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, and I've got some kind of a nest egg coming my way, so I'll be paying and I'll be on plum again and flush, and I'll be kicking ass and taking names like the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. So you got medical, right?
Well, I've been ping-ponging in and out of the hospital. This time it looks like I might stay out for a while.
Look at MMS. Okay, you can find it on our website under health. Okay, you know, most diseases are caused by pathogens. They don't know exactly. They call it, the institutions, the medical industry and stuff. They call it idiopathic. They really don't know because they're a bunch of idiots, you know. But they don't know what causes it, and they don't know how to treat it, and people live with it. Well, look at most heart diseases. They're idiopathic, but they're caused by pathogens, okay? Diabetes, okay, pathogens. All these diseases, there's like 100 of them, okay? They're idiopathic, and they're all caused by pathogens. If you could figure a way to kill the pathogens like your heart or your lung or whatever it may be, if it's not destroyed, it could be repaired then. You know, remember, you know, you get a cut. You may have a scar. You get a cut, and the cut heals. As long as you continue living, the cut can heal, okay? And you may have a scar, but you can still work with it. You still have your finger or your hand or whatever the case may be. Some cases, they could sew it back on. Well, it's the same thing in the inner parts of your body. It's self-healing as long as you don't destroy the lung or the heart or the liver or whatever it is, as long as it's not destroyed, there's a good chance of healing it. But the thing is you gotta stop the disease first. And most diseases are caused by pathogens. MMS kills all pathogens, and it doesn't injure any of the good bacteria or anything. It leaves it alone. For instance, if you take an antibiotic, okay, and you fill yourself up with that to try to kill some disease or something that you have, it also destroys the flora in your gut, and that's the good bacteria you need in order to be healthy. So they're destroying the flora, the good bacteria, while they're killing the bad bacteria, and then they don't replenish it, or they don't tell people to replenish it. You know, you got to therefore go back and take probiotics. Of course, eating yogurt, it's not enough in yogurt, but yogurt will help because it's got the bacteria in it. But you got to get these bacteria back into your gut. And that could take years, and that also can cause other diseases and problems because that bacteria is doing something for your body. So MMS does not injure any of the good bacteria in your body, but it does kill anything that's bad, any pathogen that is destructive to the body, it kills. And it digs down deep. And it takes, sometimes the cure is long. I have a doctor friend of mine who spent many, many years trying to get cured of Lyme disease. And in that process, they didn't find anything. But then they found out about MMS, so he tried MMS, and he told me it took 3 months of taking MMS, numerous dosage every single day for 3 months to cure the Lyme disease. And it was deep-seated in him at that point because he had been sick with Lyme disease for many years. And he cured himself of that. So anyway, look into MMS. You can find it on our website.
Well, I'll tell you what, Lyme disease is passed around by ticks. A lot of deer hunters get it.
Back to pathogens again. So,
ticks are nasty little creatures.
We're running out of time. Thank you. Okay. Let's take our next caller, Francine. I think it's Francine from Washington State.
Hi there, John. Yes, you're right. It's Francine from Washington State. How are you?
How you doing? Good, thank you.
Good. I just want to take a moment to tell you I sent you an email earlier this evening. I didn't realize Jan was out of town, and I need to talk to you about the interview for the Patriot Soapbox. So if you will please call me tomorrow, we can set up the details. They're very eager to have you on.
Okay. Do you have my phone number?
I'm sorry?
Do you have contact information for me?
I do, and I will discuss that with you offline. So if you'll please call me,
I'll send
you an email with my phone number, and so if you'll call me tomorrow, that would be great.
So the number you came in on, I can call you on that number, right?
Yes, you can.
Okay. I'll call you in the morning.
Thank you, John. Have a good evening.
Thank you. All right. You too. Bye-bye. Okay, let me make sure I got this number down. Francine. Okay, let's take our next caller from California. First name from California. You've been, is it Jamil?
Yes, that's my name, sir. I had some questions, basically. I have two children. Well, actually, I have four children. I've raised two boys. And one of my children, they terminated my parental rights. Now, this was about a month ago. And I have another child. Now, my daughter, the first child that they terminated the parental rights, she was 11 months old. And I had did everything that they had asked. And what had happened, because that was the second child, my other child, I go to court in September for, and they're going to be trying to terminate the parental rights. Now, I came across this, your website, the NLA, basically just feeling like this is, that was not, that our country was just not made like that for them to just take children like that.
Right.
I've donated all my, I've been a coach for football for I have a 19-year-old I've raised since he was a baby. And I had another child who was 10 years old. So my question to you is basically, if I file and I contest the jurisdiction, if I go into this family court to get it out of here, because the judge is just, he set my, my baby who's 11 months, he basically set that up for when she was born. Basically, he made sure that we didn't even visit the child. So by the time 11 months would come by, the best interest was with the person, they're, you know, with the two people that he lives with, which are like two married, these two married women, and that's my daughter. And then my son, who I have a court date. Now, I filed a JV-180, which means it's a change of circumstances, a drastic change of circumstances, which I have a job. I did everything that I was supposed to do. And these things were already put in stone. I mean, they're getting that Title V, you know, Social Security fund money. And it's just, it's wicked, dude. It's so wrong. And so now I found you guys, and I'm like, okay, this is what our country was based on. You know, I've been taking the civics courses, and I'm just excited about it. But at the same time, we have a problem right now in America where there should be some type of expedite of helping us parents get our children back as soon as possible, because while we're waiting for this gradual our children, I mean, you're talking about a generation that is going to be gone without us even knowing. I was taken away from my mom, too, when I was 10 years old, from 10 to 18. So I've lived on both sides of it. I mean, from them trying to, you know, stuff drugs and me going, no, I don't want them. I know how the entire system is just making money. What can I do right now? Do I file jurisdiction
The whole system is upside down and evil and wrong, and they're not there to help people. They're just there to ultimately to destroy, in my opinion. It's all about money. If you really dig down deep, it's all about money. That whole court system is about money. It's RICO on steroids, and the damage they do is just it's just so horrible. My parents were foster parents. We've taken in lots of children, and we ended up, as time went on, adopting two of those children. My parents, they adopted, they took in children through a Christian organization that was dealing with children who had problems with their parents or whatever the case may be. And in that process, the way things worked, which I observed, you know, their parents would come to our house all the time. I mean, not all the time, but maybe at least a couple of times a month. The parents would come to the house, and my mother would spend time with them, and they'd talk, and they'd be able to visit their child, and so on and so forth. And as the process went on, and I don't know how much state involvement was involved in this thing, but it was a Christian thing. And as time went on, eventually these children would go back to the parents. And we even had contact with some of these people even after that fact, when the children went back. I developed close relationships with some of these children. They became like brother and sister to me, you know. And then, like I said, we ended up two of the children. The parents just didn't participate in anything, and they gave them up for adoption, and we ended up adopting two of the children. And that's my experience as a child growing up in a home where my parents were not only parents to, my brothers and sisters and myself, but also to other children.
That's a good situation, because when I was raised up, when I was taken at 10, I was in a good foster home, but my sister, she was put into a foster home where she was forced to watch pornography, and then basically she was molested. This is in a foster home, and my mom's still mad with the situation to this day. They moved my sister, but the house was able to still have foster children after the fact.
Here's the problem. The system doesn't work. Okay,
it doesn't.
We need a different system. We have a proposal of a different system, we're not going to get into the details at this point. But as time goes on, it's something we do have
anytime
to deal with.
Incentive to keep the child away from the parents, by all means, there's no incentive they get for reuniting our kids back to us. They only get incentive for keeping them away from us. So what can I do? Can I file for the jurisdiction on the family court, or will they hear that? Or, I mean, what are my options?
Look, they're not going to hear it from you. if you understand the system and how to do this and, you know, and understand how the process works and how to move the case and maintain the narrative and keep them on the defense,
I'm learning.
You always offense. If you can't do that, you're not going to be able to handle this case at all. We could work with you on this. They
yes.
have to look at it. If there is something there, then they need to take this into a court of law, because the court system they have is just, everybody is destroyed. Everybody. Every child gets a lawyer. Every parent gets a lawyer. You have 6-7 lawyers
yeah.
arguing mm-hmm. and deciding what's going to go on for your children. God gave them to you. It didn't give them to them. Now, if there is a problem, problems can be, many times problems can be corrected over time and repair can take place. And, you know, that's what seemed to happen with the children that my parents took in. You know, she was always working. My father, particularly my mother was the most involved in this, always working to get a relationship with the children's parents and working with them to get things back. I mean, there are other people, too. Involved, and I don't know what that was about, but this was a Christian foster system that was set up. I don't know how it all works, but what I see here is all state, and that's a problem. I don't even know if the Catholic Church or maybe a Jewish organization or some other religious organization, if they even do those things anymore. But
is there any way to get parental rights back? I'm sorry.
Well, they don't have the authority to take your parental rights away unless you're that destructive to the child, and that takes
no,
a lot of proof.
No, not at all.
But,
there was no due process. There was nothing.
That's the point. They don't have the jurisdiction. They don't have due process. That's your argument.
And I've never been charged as a crime. I was never charged for anything. Basically, I had an allegation that I was basically on drugs. Now, I went through a rehab, did everything I did, you know, for them. I've had over 54 clean tests. They've never even tested me dirty.
Right.
I mean, it's just, it's so crazy. My daughter, I was in a rehab for 10 months out of her 11-month
life. Hold on a minute, because we're just run out of time. But let me give you a thought or an idea, and we could talk more next week if you want. But
okay.
Go onto our website, nationallibertyalliance.org.
Okay.
Go to Due Process. Click on Due Process. Read through that page very carefully. And then at the bottom, there's an access point to the due process information. The top one is a joinder. You'll have to give us a synopsis of the case, okay? Very, you know, short synopsis. We don't want anything lengthy or long, but give us the idea what's going on. And
okay.
then it's a matter of filling out some information, and then we'll go through the process of helping you to file the papers and move the case. Eventually, if they don't stop, then we move it into the federal court for cause and take it from there.
Hey, that's great. And I was going to send $100, too, this week. So I was doing all that. I'm in the process, and that's why I wanted to touch base with you.
All right, well, go through that. And look at, you know, these things don't seem to work very well. They're very they battle these things. They refuse to obey the law and so on and so forth. But we are at a point where the times, they are changing. The whole environment of the courts are going to change drastically, probably in the next couple of weeks. As soon as all of the evil starts to be revealed to the general public of what's really going on, things are going to change, and these people in the courts are going to realize they don't have protection anymore, and that's when we're going to get power and authority and leverage and justice. And it's all in the timing here. So with that, I got to go, though.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time, man.
Right,
and
thank you.
I'll touch base with, I guess, Jan. I just shoot him an email with the
get all the overview. Intake. Go.
Oh, intake.
Read.
Intake. Gotcha.
Yeah. Look at,
gotcha.
Read the page first and get to the next page and just get a hold of intake at nationallibertyalliance.org. James, we'll get in contact with you and work you through the process.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you. All right, we do have a couple of people left in the queue, but it's 12 o'clock, and we got to close down. Hopefully next week we'll get the people that we missed. And Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. Meanwhile, let's everybody continue to get educated, because knowledge is power. and we can't have authority, we can't have power, and we can't have liberty without that knowledge. Okay, thanks everyone for showing up. Good night.